Coming up on Boston Public Radio, they tethered themselves the 1,200-pound barrels blocking 93 during rush hour. Now, we assume you believe that Black Lives Matter, but do you believe this morning's action is the right way to make the point? Commuters, give us a call. Then Karen Miller and what I've been waiting for years, the smart home, knows which family member enters a room, so adjusts temps and music just for them. You ready? And speaking of ready, the new governor is. From sickbed to Studio 3, Governor Charlie Baker joins us and you from noon to one on his first monthly Ask the Governor. Call, email, or send your questions to hashtag AskBaker.
Harvard Business School's Michael Norton. His new research shows how most of us trust our random thoughts, first impressions, and even dreams more than our deliberately considered ideas. Then Jared Bowen gives us his analysis of the 2015 Oscar picks. All coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hey, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. We should say in an hour, the new governor will be joining us for the first of his monthly Ask the Governor appearances. And if you want to get in ahead of the game, you can email questions now. A lot of people have already. A lot of people have. To bpr@wgbh.org. Or you can send with the hashtag AskBaker. Again, Charlie Baker, the new governor, will be with us from 12 to 1. And obviously you can call him as well. But first, civil disobedience is alive, and I was going to say well, but depending on your point of view. As you know, this morning a group of protesters in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement scattered across I-93 and attached themselves to these 1,200-pound traffic barrels. They did this just as thousands of you were making your way to work. It was a low-maintenance operation that obviously had a high impact. Maybe you're among those who were stuck in traffic this morning. And even if you weren't, our question to you is, even if you're with these protesters, with any protest, actually, in spirit, does your solidarity sag when you're the one who's inconvenienced? Does it make you feel like a hypocrite if you fall into that category? Our number is 877-301-8970. But first, before we get to your calls, joining us online is Boston Herald photographer Mark Garfinkel. He's been there all morning long. He's currently in East Milton Square. Mark, great to talk to you.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hey, Mark. Thank you for taking the time to join us. So what was the scene like down there when you arrived?
I probably got here about 15 minutes after the first police officer, the state police officer, which I heard on the police scanner. He was perplexed. He said, "You better get the lieutenant down here right away." So he wasn't sure, you know, what they were going to do with these barrels. The problem was he then called for jackhammers to come to the scene. So interesting stuff.
So where were they? Were they situated, the people with their arms in the barrels? And by the way, apparently they had concrete poured on their arms so they couldn't take their arms out of the barrel. That's what I read this morning, Mark, correct? So the arms were stuck inside these barrels. Where were they?
That's correct, and they were across all four lanes, and then they were able to push some of the barrels off to the far right lane, and then also to the far left high speed lane, and then the middle two lanes were going by for a little bit anyway until they had to get Boston fire trucks came in with more expertise equipment.
You know, I don't quite understand. When they say moved them to the side of the road, I assume they couldn't have rolled them to the side of the road because they would have been rolling the protester too. What did they do with these 1,200-pound kegs? What did they do?
I was not here for that. Oh. I had heard that they walked they dragged the protesters a little bit as they rolled the barrel.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness!
And what was really interesting here was, I mean, this was like, I kept thinking back to that movie. What was it? Dog Day Afternoon with
Al Pacino.
Everybody going, 80, 90, 95% of the people going by were either giving a finger to these people or saying, "Get a job, you bum."
And were the protesters screaming an Attica-like chant, or were they just quiet?
No, they were very disciplined, very quiet, until the work started to be done on their arms and on the barrels. And then at times they would scream out, you know, just screaming out. One said, "You're hurting me." You know, I think they were just, at that point, that was part of the protest as well.
Yeah.
There seemed to be an interesting, you know, getting on together well down there between the state police and the protesters, you know, making sure that they were okay. They were making sure that, you know, they weren't in the middle of the street, like legs were pushed off to the side because they were kind of, you know, one police officer didn't want their feet to be run over, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So there was no kind of violent kind of thing going on between the cops and the protesters. Things were fairly peaceful. Hey, by the way,
20, according to the Globe, by the way, I don't know what the
there were arrests,
23
yeah.
arrests, 17 at the Medford site, 6 at the Milton site.
By the way, Mark Garfinkel, fantastic photographer for the Herald. I looked at your photographs this morning. Did you see anybody black? This was about Black Lives Matter. All the photographs I saw were of white people. It looked a little bit like the Occupy protesters. Did you see anyone that wasn't white?
It, just like what you said, it looked like the very similar to the faces of the occupiers.
Yeah. Okay.
Hey, Mark. As always, your photos are great, and we really appreciate your time. Mark Garfinkel from the Boston Herald, great photographer and great caller. Thanks so much for your time. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
You know, I should say, we're going to take your calls at 877-301-8970. How you feel about this thing? And let me declare myself right away as a capital H hypocrite. I am a big supporter of protest. I'm, by the way, a big supporter of protest, even when I don't agree with the subject matter, with the concept of the protest. I like that kind. I like people being heard. But as soon as I am inconvenienced, you know, through the years, the most recent example I can think of is while I'm not a cyclist and I do have some issues, I really like the idea that people are cycling more. It's healthier.
Right.
It's better for the environment, all that sort of thing. I was in Harvard Square a few years ago, and I had to pick up one of my kids. It was probably 7 or 8 or 10 years ago as well, because she was still fairly young. And there was, I think it's called corking, where the cyclists protest.
Oh, yeah,
they
block.
Just stop their bikes. And a young cyclist moved his bicycle onto my front bumper. And all I can say is it was a fairly tense situation. And by the way, I don't know if you remember this. When I came into work the next day, still aggravated about it, and I'm telling our producer, Matt, at our old station how upset I am, he timidly told me that his sister was one of the corking protesters. In any case, 877-301-8970. One last thing I'll say is for those of you who were really absolutely out of your minds over this thing, they did achieve their goal, is we wouldn't have known. If they were
right
on the side of the road
That's
doing
right.
it, there might have been a little tiny nib in the Globe or the Herald. The only reason we're talking about a Black Lives Matter protest, mm-hmm. for better or worse, is because they decided to inconvenience you and everybody on 93.
That's right. I'm squarely in that hypocritical
group good.
Because I love the fact that they were out there. Had I been delayed for work for 45 minutes, or I had an important appointment, or I had to get to the doctor's, or I had to drop off the kid at the babysitter's, whatever it was, I would have been one of those people that I don't know if I would have. I would have given them the finger and screamed, "Get a job." But I would have been pretty ticked off that they were delaying me on my way to wherever I wanted to get.
And we should cite Mark Garfinkel. Well, it was not scientifically accurate. He'd be the first. He said roughly 95% of the drivers were exhibiting one
yes.
of those two and
yes.
Antagonistic
and,
behaviors.
And as he said, he
protesters.
Was there 15 minutes after the whole thing began. So he had a view from beginning to end. Anyway, let's start with Mariah in Dorchester. Hi.
Hi there.
Hello. Hi. I was stuck in traffic during this protest.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, I totally supported it. Even though I was stuck in traffic, I was happy that it was traffic for cars instead of a pileup because of somebody text driving. And I totally agree with you.
That's a good point.
About, you know, the hypocrisy of it, you know. You know, people won't mind if it was an accident. But a lot of people show agitation because it was a protest. Also, there's going to be a protest on Martin Luther King's Day at the Old State House at 1 p.m., and I'm going to join that one, show support.
Hey, could you pronounce your name so I don't get it wrong? Say it again.
Mahira.
Mahira, there was no piece of you that, even though you were as a matter of principle with the protesters, there was no piece of you that was aggravated by the fact that you were delayed wherever you're going?
A little bit, but, you know, usually it's like the flip of a coin with the traffic in Boston, especially.
Anyway, right?
Yeah,
that's a great point.
She's a more patient woman than either you are or I am, Jim.
Mahira, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. I mean, that's the way I'd like to be. If I support the right to protest, then theoretically you should be okay with being inconvenienced if that's part of the protesters' behavior.
Why are the bicyclists blocking the intersection? What's that?
It was it was a cyclist rights kind of thing. I don't know why. It wasn't some specific thing that happened. It was more.
I think I'd be more ticked off about the cyclist rights than I would be about the Black Lives Matter.
Oh, let me just tell you, you know me fairly well. I really took it well. I really was very calm. And by the way, you know what was even worse? I was the last car that didn't get through before they started the corking. So it was even worse.
So how long are you delayed for?
Maybe an hour. And I was relatively fine until the guy backed his bicycle onto my bumper.
Let me
just
say one other thing. I was coming home from New York City, and I forget where it was. It was over the Christmas holiday. And there was that tractor trailer that tipped over on the Massachusetts Turnpike that blocked traffic in both directions. I was delayed at literally 3 hours. Mm-hmm. I was an hour away from home. It took me another 4 hours to get home because the traffic was at an absolute standstill. And, you know, it barely made the papers. If it did, it was buried somewhere. I hardly even saw it.
Well, why are you saying that?
I'm saying that we are all talking about this, which was a far less, in terms of inconvenience, a far smaller deal because it wasn't a three-hour delay. I mean, people are out of there. It's now 11 o'clock and traffic is moving and stuff like that. So we make a big deal about this. People become absolutely irate about this. And we didn't make a big deal at all about people being delayed for a much longer period of time.
But the response to that, and I hear you and I agree with you, is that one was intentional and one was unintentional. And so, and by the way, the delay, at least according to the Globe story, bostonglobe.com this morning, is while the thing started in the 7:30 to 7:40 range, at least the Milton part of it was not totally cleared. Some lanes were not totally cleared for 2 hours. So I guess there was traffic going through relatively quickly, single lane, two lanes, whatever. But the ultimate clearing took till apparently till 9:45.
Christopher's calling this whole thing radical chic.
Well, you know, listen, inconvenience is part of the mix. I mean, it is. And I think Mahira probably is the calmest and most principled of us all. Let's go to Brighton. Well, we're in Brighton. We don't have to go anywhere. Jeff, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call. Hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Great.
I got to say, I'm 100% in favor of what they did.
Yep.
I feel like what so often happens around these protests is that everybody gets upset. A lot of stuff happens. And then there's this I think everybody just waits for it to die down. The people who are making the decisions, the people who are sort of trying to keep the status quo are like, well, let them get upset, let them calm down. And I think until we see, you know, huge disruptions to the status quo and things are happening, you're going to continue to just like watch these movements come and go and nothing's going to change. I think that's how things change, is that people get upset, you know?
No, I agree with you. And by the way, you know, one of the other ironies, I don't know why I thought of this while you were talking, Jeff, so my apologies if it's a bit of a different direction. Marjorie and I saw Selma a couple of weeks ago, and we've talked about it almost nonstop with different guests. Everybody is celebrating that level of inconvenience because those ordinary people had the courage to do – now, talk about inconvenience. They were also arrested, beaten, some of them even killed. That, in the abstract, is fine with us because we believe in the cause. And even if you believe in the cause here, most people, unlike you and Mahira, are not willing to pay the price. Jeff, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. So we both branded ourselves hypocrites.
Hypocrites.
Do you think we would have been more principled had we been on the road and we said, we took a deep breath and we said, listen, we know we feel bad about the inconvenience, but hey, this is the price of protest.
You know, I would hope I feel a little funny about, and I'm glad that it's a multiracial kind of thing. I'm glad a lot of white people are getting involved in this. I would feel a little funny if all I saw was a bunch of white college kids.
Why?
I don't know.
Why? What do you care? If they care about, they care about. What does it care?
I guess.
I mean, it's great if everything is multiracial and all levels of, you know, strata of society. But if there are a bunch of people who in their hearts care about an issue you care about or care about any issue strongly enough, what do you care what they're?
Well, I guess it's okay. It just seems like they're looking for something to protest or what is this really a heartfelt kind of thing?
Well, because they're all white, allegedly? First of all, we don't know that they're all white. I mean, that's your observation from photos and Mark. Mark didn't see every protest.
He did not see every protest.
So, but even if they are, that's then they are. I mean, that's something they got to deal with.
I like it better when they're multiracial.
So do I.
I want multiracial protests.
Our number is 877-301-8970. We're talking about the protests on 93 this morning that inconvenienced thousands and thousands and thousands of commuters.
Yeah, that conversation is going to continue in just a couple of seconds here on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marjorie. If you just joined us, we're talking about what everybody's talking about, this morning's protesters. They closed down all lanes of Route 93, south and north, for a while. They did this in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement. Just about everybody in the Bay State got the message loud and clear, and so we're asking you the obvious. Are you someone who is with protesters in spirit, but not in body when you're the one who's being inconvenienced? Does your inner, does your inner hypocrite rise to the surface? Or do you consider the inconvenience as a way of, participating in the protesters' cause, or at least supporting it? 877-301-8970.
Daphne from Charlestown. Thanks for calling, Daphne.
Hello, Daphne.
Hi, hello. It's interesting that you brought up the, I would say, the racial makeup of the protests, because, one, I'm very much a person of color. I attended all of the Occupy protests, and when I was there, I saw plenty of brown people. Two, being fair-skinned does not mean you're not a person of color. And three, as for a bunch of white kids protesting, you can say maybe they're not as legitimate as brown faces protesting Black Lives Matter. However, the intent is important. So if the intent is just for them to have something to do, maybe it devalues the protest. However, if it brings it to the forefront and it makes it known to people who are not paying attention or who do not think that these protests matter, perhaps that is important too. So I just want to, like, make those points.
Well, to me, Daphne.
Don't go away, Daphne.
To me, can I just finish, please?
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
Everything's black and white and black and white. But here's the thing. Among people of color, we've been discussing these issues forever. It's time for white people to get involved because they are part of the problem and the solution. And if you want to say something's multiracial, multiracial doesn't mean everyone at that one point in time has to have like this rainbow coalition of races. It could be just a bunch of white teens from a local college around here.
No, we got it.
We got your point, too. Daphne. I mean, here's the thing, and maybe this doesn't resonate with you, but as a woman, when there's a big protest involving women's rights, I don't want it to be all men out there protesting. I kind of want a little bit more of a multi-gender kind of thing. And it's the same thing with me. I mean, if there were a lot of black people or Asian people or Hispanic people or whatever, it just kind of, you know, I don't want the men to own my issue in the same way I don't want a bunch of white kids from Emerson College or anything to own, you know, an issue that's predominantly affecting young black men. So it doesn't bother you, but it bothers me a little bit. But thanks for the call.
Thank you, Daphne.
Mateo from Newton, thank you for calling.
Hey, Mateo.
Hi, yes. I was calling. Well, first I wanted to, you know, I'm glad that you're addressing the fact that the protest was successful, that inconvenience is ultimately the goal of all protests, and that, you know, we tend to gloss over the fact that the civil rights movement, originally in the 60s, you know, it was, you know, America didn't get one little nudge and decide, oh, wait, racism is bad. It was a decade of inconvenience. So I'm glad of that. But I actually recognize that. But what I was ultimately calling about was I went online to read articles about this, and the people's reactions are very visceral and violent and racist, saying things that, you know, they should arrest them and beat them. They should get plows out on the street to clear them off. It's very, very brutal.
Yeah. Well, you know, commenters on stories often aren't the best. You know what I mean? A lot of commenters on stories are kind of brutal in general.
You kind of wonder
if they're in their basement of their mother's house or something like that.
No, it's by the way, for whatever that's worth, I'm not at all cheapening the point you're making, Mateo, about the criticism, because Mark Garfinkel described the drivers themselves. I think there is a special subset of people who, as Marjorie said, who do post responses to these stories.
I also wanted to make the point about these commenters, along with the brutality of their statements. They were saying things along the lines that, you know, all lives matter. All these protests are so racist. You know, all lives should matter, not just black lives. They're race baiting. But they seem to be ignoring the issue that, you know, these protests aren't about all lives. It's about a specific subset within our population that is being disproportionately negatively impacted by law enforcement. So, yes, no one argues that all lives matter, but we're talking about black lives right now.
Yeah, but Mateo, that is what you were, Mateo, what you were falling for, with all due respect, is the tired old tactic of people who want to argue that those who are complaining about racism are themselves racist. And that is the tired, not what you're saying, what you're responding to is the tiredest old tactic, as if people who are arguing that Black Lives Matter don't care about other lives. Of course they do. I assume they do. I hope they do. But the focus is on what happened in the last several months that most people, a lot of people, feel were dealt with unjustly. Mateo, thank you much for the call. 877-301-8970. Or you can email us at BPR. It's the first time I've ever given out the email, I think. BPR@WGBH.org.
Sean from Dedham, I'm sure, knowing you a little bit, that you were completely down with the message and spirit and heartfelt emotions of the protesters on I-93, Sean. Am I right?
Jim, I applaud these people, and I'll tell you why. They're protesting against EBT fraud, and I think that's great.
Oh, my God.
Okay, Sean. You didn't happen to be stuck in the traffic, did you?
Not at all. Jimmy, if they had any guts, they'd be there Sunday for the Pats game. Let's see how they go against 65,000 screaming Pats fans.
Now, Sean, in a moment of seriousness here, you in part drive as part of your living, correct?
Yeah, but not over near there, thank God.
Okay, no, I know. But let's pick something that you – I mean, for example, in the last
– I get paid by the hour, don't forget.
I got that. So, but in the last handful of years, I would say about 95% of your calls, no matter what the topic is, you've worked the EBT card in. So let's assume there was an anti-EBT card abuse protest, and it was huge on a road that you had to travel to do your job, and you were inconvenienced by the protest whose cause you totally celebrated. What would your reaction be?
Jimmy, I would be putting my wallet up in the air and I'd be jumping, doing jumping jacks, saying, thank you, finally
that's
someone gets it. The working man isn't going to get screwed anymore.
Goodbye, Sean. It's a pleasure, as always, Sean from Dedham,
He's
who we've known for many years.
He's not consistent.
Yes, he is.
Yes, he is. Steve from Dedham. What do you think, Steve?
Hello, Steve.
Oh, it's Steve.
I'm sorry. What? Say that again?
We lost
the connection.
Him.
Steve, we're going to put your line on hold, and if we retrieve it, we'll get back to you just in a minute. I'm sorry about that.
Alec from Dover. Thank you for calling, Alec.
Hi, Alec.
Yeah, apart from – hey, guys. Apart from Sean, I really couldn't say it better than the first two callers. And I think that, like you mentioned, the Facebook and the social media, the comments really are astounding. And I know that they always come out of the woodwork, you know, when things like this happen. But they really do prove the protesters' point. People are saying they should be jailed. They should rot in jail for the day. They shouldn't, you know, have their bails posted. And you know, these are people who are, you know, protesting. The protesters are in fact protesting, you know, that these, you know, killer racist cops are not being thrown in jail for horrendous, absolutely horrendous crimes, and the battle cries from, you know, everyone from Facebook to Twitter is actually astounding. But I think they're making the point. So as much as, you know, it's great that everyone is hearing this, I think the real point lies within the response. And I think that's something that the first two callers were getting at as well.
Alec, but the only thing I want to take issue with is I'm not sure everybody who's upset about a failure of grand juries to indict in Ferguson and in Staten Island believe that all we saw were racist killer cops. I think they think that a murder or something like it was committed in one or both of those circumstances. But I'm not sure everybody goes
I don't know that anybody
that far.
Thinks it was murder. Do people think it was
murder
in the Michael Brown case?
Oh, in Michael Brown case.
I think
no,
that
that's
was
true.
A lot more cloudy of an issue than the Eric Garner case.
But he did kill him. Alec, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
He did kill him. And we should point out, too, you know, not all cops obviously are racist. I mean, there's a.
Well, I don't think Alec was even saying.
No,
that.
But it's important. It's important to say that. On the other hand, there is legitimate fear, and you've interviewed people in these situations, and I've interviewed people in these situations who've had a young son killed because they were somebody was shooting and aiming at the wrong person because they're roughed up by the cops or because unequal treatment from the system and all that, and who are living in fear that this is going to happen to another one of their children, or that they're afraid if their son who's a black kid and 6 feet tall is walking down the street, you know, and minding his own business, something terrible is going to happen to him. There's a
like de Blasio.
Yes.
By the way, you know, one of the points,
fear about that.
One of the points that the police commissioner in Boston made the other day when he was here, Bill Evans, and we asked him about what his reaction was to the cops turning their back in New York City, many of the cops turning their back on de Blasio at the funeral, at the press conference, at the hospital, et cetera. His view was, it's of course fine for him to tell his son whatever he wants. The issue was publicizing, telling the world that I just spoke to my biracial son and warned him about how police treat people whose skin, young men whose skin is not white. Do you agree with Evans that he should have kept it to himself?
No. I mean, I love the commissioner, but I think it's like I just said, I think if you are a parent of a black kid or a biracial kid, you're petrified, son, particularly, because it usually happens to son. You worry about this all the time. And we've all done the stories. Every single person you ever interview who's black, who is had a fantastic career, from a colleague, Callie Crossley, who's a woman, to people that we've interviewed. I'm forgetting the judge's name now that was picked up by the cops at 12 years old and driven around town for a robbery he didn't commit. Everybody has a story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
Eric Holder has a story.
Eric Holder has a story. Deval Patrick has a story. Everybody has a story. So this is a legitimate thing, being treated differently by the cops if you're a black kid. So, you know, on the other hand, you know, I don't know what the other hand is I was going to say. Sorry.
Well, the old line, the other hand, five fingers. Now, let me just say one more thing.
Think about what the commissioner said about de Blasio?
I have to say, I agree with you for all people. When he made the point about the mayor of a city where there is strife, I think he may have a point. I'm not sure how I feel.
Okay.
But he gave me
so
pause.
So should the cops have turned their back on the mayor of New York City?
No, I think it was a really bad move.
I don't think they should.
Really bad move. And by the way,
either.
Not because they don't have a right to do that, of course. But because, as I said, to Commissioner Evans, I think it helps even further weaken the trust of the people and the ability of those who lead their city, cops, mayors, whomever, to bring peace to their city.
Well, not only that, it became a big part of the story.
Right.
Instead of the story of the two officers who were
very
assassinated.
Very fine point. 877-301-8970. But what we're talking about for just a couple of more minutes are the protests on 93 this morning, a Black Lives Matter protest that shut down traffic, or at least inhibited traffic flow for much of a couple of hours between 7:30, 7:40, and late in the 9 o'clock hour. And according to Mark Garfinkel, extraordinary photographer for the Boston Herald, who was there since maybe 10 minutes after it began until we talked to him a little after 11, as he said, 95% of the drivers were either screaming at the protesters to go get a job or were giving them what he described as the finger.
Now, we're talking about people commenting on stories and how vicious they were, in some cases racist. Racist they are. Well, we don't have – this is not a racist email, but Greg thinks that the so-called protesters must be held for 15 days psychiatric observation, foolish enough to attempt suicide, endanger others in this way, are absolutely sick and demented. So he has a very I would say he's not impressed by the protesters.
Apparently not. Let's go to – let's try Steve Needham one more time. Steve, welcome to Boston Public Radio. We hope.
Yes, I'm on.
Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to say a couple things. This protest started months ago, and they shut down Newbury Street. I was there.
Yep.
I was marching. I'm not of color.
Yeah.
Well, I'm Irish color. And
Marjorie's sort of like that too.
Yeah.
Steve, go ahead.
Yeah. But people weren't rude, and I went to another one, and there was one counter protester. But the first one on Newbury Street was never covered by the media. So I'm saying, keep it up, guys. Keep it up. I wish I was there with you today.
You know, by the way, I don't know. I accept that you believe it wasn't covered by the media. I don't know personally that it wasn't. But your underlying point is a wonderful one. If people weren't upset on Newbury Street, it didn't become newsworthy. Because they are upset, we're having yet another conversation, not just about the protest, but about the underlying cause, which was really their goal. Steve, thanks for calling. You know what the big, most controversial kind of protest, which really that drove people absolutely over the wall? PETA. Remember, like maybe in the 90s
oh, yeah.
in particular, PETA, people, just totally, even people who believed in animal rights. Was there any organization who knew how to get press better than the PETA people?
I think a lot of people didn't like it when they were throwing blood at women walking down Madison Avenue wearing, but when PETA got really smart and decided to have these gorgeous looking women wearing almost no clothes and barrels, I think things turned around very quickly. You joined immediately, as I recall.
Right, like,
you know, we have a lot of emailers.
Beach volleyball.
We have a lot of emailers saying something that's fairly predictable after something like this, that they're very supportive of the Black Lives Matter movement, and they understand completely there's an issue with cops and young black men, but they feel as though these protests like this alienate supporters because people that were stuck in traffic are now hostile.
Can I tell
you
something? You'll find this hard to believe. I agree with that emailer, but that's the short term.
There are several of them who say
that's the short term. The long term, the question is, do they help get action because they keep the issue there? One last call. Let's go to Glenn. He is on 93. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Glenn.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I quite honestly believe it was disgusting. It's the wrong way to protest. And quite honestly, you might want to ask Charlie Baker. I blame the politicians. I was sitting in my car with my uncle, 84 years old, with a colostomy bag, trying to get him into Brigham and Women.
Yeah.
Why is it? Is it a lot of other, ways to get attention? Why don't we get the mayor, Mayor Walsh, Charlie Baker? Get everybody together. Make a big deal about it. Have a lot of press. There is a problem. I live in a town where a black man drives a car after dark. He probably will get pulled over. If that is disgusting also. I don't condone it.
Yeah, but Glenn, can I interrupt you? Can I interrupt you?
The wrong way of doing it.
I hear you, but Glenn, let me respond. Even though I'm not authorized to speak for the mayor, we've had this discussion with him. The mayor says he is trying to do that, but has been frustrated by the fact that he's not quite sure what it is that protesters want. He said it here. He said it elsewhere. The commissioner said the same thing. So I'm not at all.
You know, you've been around the block, Jim. You know that's a bunch of BS.
Glenn, I actually don't. Well, I'll give you another example. I was a huge, huge supporter of what the occupiers stood for. I had no idea what their agenda was either, other than to eliminate inequity in society.
Yeah, well,
most of us are against inequity in society.
You know, everybody says they had no purpose.
I didn't say no purpose. I didn't say they had no purpose.
Okay, well, I think they have totally changed the discussion. You have Republicans now talking about income inequality all the time. Marco Rubio, who may be running for president, talking about income inequality. Was he talking about it before the Occupy protest?
I believe in
agendas.
No, he was not. I believe in agendas. I think if it turns out you're protesting and you have the ability to say to the public, look, here are the three things that need to change immediately for this issue to be resolved. I think the ability to organize people around is far greater. That's
okay. Well, I think in your spare time, you should go down and be the leader of the Black Lives Matter thing. But I think that they succeeded tremendously this morning in getting everybody ticked off as people were that were stuck in traffic.
Yep, I agree.
To get everybody thinking about this again. And everybody, like I said, I wish it had been a more multicultural thing. But nonetheless, they get everybody talking about this. And it's going to be interesting to see how they manage to get the arms of the protesters, which are stuck in concrete, which is now hardened, out of these barrels.
This is an interesting thing.
The fire department was there with the power saws, and the sparks were flying, and some of the poor protesters were getting burned. So it'll be interesting to see how they get out of there. But I guess how many of them are arrested? Quite a few that don't have the police station. Okay. Coming up, Kara Miller joins us to talk about intelligent design, the future of the smart home. That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Bradley. She is Marjorie Egan, the new governor of the Commonwealth, will join us and you in about 25 minutes. So if you have questions, you can use the hashtag AskBaker, or you can email to bpr@wgbh.org, or you can call them during the hour. But first, in the future, will the everyday stuff of domestic living be emotional furniture, smart doorbells, all tended by robotic housekeepers? A smart house that's a mix of the Jetsons and Woody Allen's Sleeper. In any case, here with us in Studio 3 to talk about what it could mean to live very much on the grid, is Kara Miller, host of Innovation Hub. Hello, Kara. I am so into this topic.
Yeah.
I can't see straight.
Well, so it's really interesting because this is already happening. I mean, do either of you know anybody, or do you have a Roomba yourself?
No,
you
know? I know a lot of people who do.
Right, I know people that do. They're floor, such fun to watch.
So we're already in this era. Do you know people who have Nest thermostats?
No.
What does that mean?
Okay, so a Nest thermostat is this sort of sleek-looking black thermostat. It's round. It was actually recently acquired by Google. It's about the size of a baseball, goes on your wall. And what it does is unlike those thermostats I have a regular thermostat. I never have any idea how to program it. Nobody knows. Like, you
Amen.
Can't figure it out, right? This actually is easy to program. And not only that, it learns your behavior. So after a while, you don't have to program it because it learns what temperature you like, when you're home, that you tend to at 7 p.m. turn the thermostat down, and at 6 a.m. you're turning it up. And after a while, it learns it. It figures it out. And you can control it from your phone. I think Jared Bowen, who's often on here, has one of these thermostats
really?
That he can control from his phone.
But
yeah.
My understanding is it's on the verge of going even farther, staying with thermostats,
oh, yeah.
that your thermostat will, in the near future, be able to recognize that I walk in to my house
yes.
rather than you, Kara.
Yes.
They will know that I like it at 68 degrees, so they'll do the rooms that I hang out in
yeah.
at 68. You come in and you like it at 70, and just because it feels your presence, whatever that means,
exactly.
your room is at 70.
Well, the nice thing is we all have these handy little microprocessors on us called cell phones, and so when you're about to come home, not only does your Nest thermostat know it, but Nest is also getting into the business of washers and dryers. I heard one of the women who runs Nest speak not that long ago at MIT, and she said, we have this system now where when you're about to come home, we can start your dryer so that, like, your towel is nice and fluffy and
oh
warm.
Oh, my God.
And it's all because you've got a phone on you, and it knows where you are at all times. It knows when you're 10 blocks from your house. Like, it knows that. So I think we're entering this era. Like, if you think back 100 years to what mostly women, honestly, were doing during the day, they were doing these routine things, right? You sort of finished cooking one meal, and then you were either shopping or cooking for the next meal.
Right.
All right. Now, that pretty much is not what people do anymore. But we do a lot of routine things. We do a lot of vacuuming. We set our thermostat. We have to remember to take our medicine. We have to remember to check the weather report and see about, you know, whether we should take an umbrella. We're entering an era in which you've got umbrellas already where the handle glows. It checks the weather for you. The handle glows.
Oh, God.
If you should take it out of the, you know, umbrella holder right next to the
door. Because it's
going
to rain.
Yeah, or it's raining already. Uh-huh. Half the time I go downstairs, I look at, you know, outside, and I'm like, really? It snowed overnight? You know, I forgot to look. And, like, it will glow if, yes, it's predicted that it's going to rain that day.
One of the other utensil things that caught my eye was this cutlery and condiments that can monitor your eating habits.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Well, what you've got is you've got these microprocessors that are so little right now, they can go in everything. Ralph Lauren is actually bringing out a shirt this year that's going to figure out all sorts of stuff about you, from your blood pressure to the calories you burn, and it's just going to email it to your phone. We're talking about a shirt. We're not talking about a Fitbit. And what you see in cutlery and in condiments is them tracking, like, how much salt. And there's no problem anymore putting a little sensor in a salt shaker because these things are tiny. And so all the things that we used to put effort into thinking about, this is happening with pill bottles, too. There's a really interesting guy, David Rose, lives in Brookline. And he created that umbrella with the glowing handle. He created these pill bottles that are fantastic. So if you have not opened the pill bottle cap, it will actually glow at you, or it will play a little musical thing for you to remind you to do it.
Can you buy these now?
Yeah, so you can get them. I believe that there are certain medications. Last I talked to him about this, there were certain medications that the people who made the medications, I think like Novartis, had decided they were so important, like when you get a liver transplant or something like that, that they give them to you for free.
Wow.
Because the downside of not taking your medication in those cases is so serious and so expensive that it's worth it to pay a little more for. And it looks just like a pill bottle with that orange see-through bottom, right, and that white top. But the white top's a little bit thicker because it's got this little sensor in there. But what it can do is not just tell you, it can email your mom or your daughter across the country and say, you know, mom hasn't touched her pills today.
Oh, my gosh.
Yep. You know, we're talking to Karen Miller from Innovation Hub. You know, when I first heard that we're talking to you about this, and I said, when you walked in, I said how excited I was about this. And I think I am. And yeah, I read one of the things. Yeah, everybody likes a weird – Marjorie likes the little, you know, the knife and spoon or whatever it is. And I assume the next
smart
step,
spoon.
The smart spoon that's going to not allow you to put food in your mouth if it's over your caloric. No, I'm serious. But the other thing I love,
it turns out,
I love the thing
beat you up with
that senses which person in your family is within a mile of the house, so that by your door it starts playing music that you like, so you're welcome into your house with your family. I mean, that's however. This is a however here.
Right.
The however is what you're describing, and I don't know if this concerns me, is where you don't have to make any decisions. Essentially, your life is programmed based upon your behaviors, the music you like, the food, whatever it is we've discussed in the last couple minutes, the temperature you like in your house, the time you want to get up, the time you go to bed. Should that worry us at all, that essentially the thought process is eliminated? Or should we say this is so efficient that we can be thinking and doing things that matter more?
I mean, it's a really interesting question, and it's one I've struggled with too, because it is kind of weird for the temperature to always be right for you and never have to deal with uncomfortability. Mm-hmm. Now, one point here is
that's a better point than what I made. Your point was a great point, to not have to deal with discomfort.
Well, but as long as you and some member of your family or Marjorie or a producer or whoever are in the same room and you guys have differences in the temperature that you want, the same problem is still going to exist. It's only that scenario only works when you're in the room by yourself, right?
Yeah.
So as long as there's other people, there's still, you know, there's still issues. For me, actually, one of the big issues here is hacking. I mean, when your thermostat and your washing machine knows when you're home and when you're not, and somebody can hack that and they know exactly what your schedule is, that's a little concerning. Well, somebody also knows presumably they also know what you eat and what your blood pressure is and all sorts of things about the medication you take. I mean, you know, granted, there's already a lot of information. I put this to David Rose, and he said, you know, Google's been reading my email for 10 years. I'm not that worried.
Yeah, a lot of people have that same attitude. But there's this one thing, one of these stories talks about this small device that you wear around your wrist, and it will authenticate your identity, which you talked about before, for the heat. But I thought to myself, it will also make, if you're not, if a thief, you know, would be, I would assume that would, there would be tied up in some way to someone that shouldn't be in the house, being in the house.
What do you mean? But well, there's a sensor, I assume, in the thing that identifies you. If it's on the wrist of somebody.
But how far can it be if they can figure out how to have some warning device that goes if someone enters the house who is not supposed to be there? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like almost a theft prevention kind of thing.
Well,
because if everybody's supposed to be there has one of these wrist things, and then someone is there without one.
So, I mean, you can always try to jump ahead of this. Apple has been really at the forefront of fingerprint technology, right? And it's very hard to duplicate somebody's fingerprints. So if it's not even something you wear, not something you can lose, not something that can be stolen, but in fact, it's your eye, right? In government work, there are places where it's your eye that they look at to see whether you are the person who belongs in that building or your fingerprint or whatever. So I do think there is going to be an effort to stay a step ahead. We've seen with the Sony hack, whatever, hackers are smart and they figure out ways to get around this stuff. But I think that horse is out of the barn too. I think what's really interesting here is when you don't have to vacuum anymore and you don't have to think about the heat and you don't really have to think about your towels, like what do you do? And in a lot of ways, what we're being freed up to do, we've talked about self-driving cars a little bit on this show, you know, is creative things. But that means that we're all being moved sort of up the chain of having to do these sort of heady things. And I hope we can find enough to do.
Well, you know what's, interesting about that is I've said many times on the show, I don't know if to you, Marjorie, knows this as well. I like doing mundane things, and in part because they distract you and they calm me down. What we appear to be on the verge of eliminating the need to do almost all mundane kinds of things. And so the question is, the good news is we have time for things that theoretically matter, for thinking, for being more creative. But it also puts much more pressure on you. You know what right. I mean? No, I mean, the I diversion know. Of doing the dishes. I'm one of the few oh. people alive that actually likes doing the dishes.
Wait a minute.
Not mounds
Wait a
and
minute.
What?
Wait a minute. My dishwasher broke yeah. over Christmas, and I still haven't gotten a new dishwasher.
You still haven't washed the dishes and since Christmas.
In my household, you know, with everybody around over Christmas and all the kids and all their friends and everything else, I have spent so much time washing the dishes, I barely have time to brush my teeth.
Yeah, but how
teeth.
Many times do you have 20 people at your house,
well,
Marjorie? I'm talking about normal living.
Normal living, you have three or four people every night you're cooking dinner for. I mean, it really
yeah,
adds up.
It does.
The dishwashing is very time-consuming. Well, but the first day I was very zen about it, thinking, oh, I'll mindfully wash the dishes. That's what they say in all these books. Be mindful. Look at the suds. Look at the sponge. Notice how you're rubbing the grease with the sponge. And that, you know, my day two is forget about it. I want a new dishwasher. I mean,
okay, but
these
wait a second. But wait a
take
second.
Forever.
Let me make my case here a little bit better. So you can order anything you could order in a store by shopping around. You can go online and order. You browse essentially mm-hmm. online. You don't have to go to the supermarket anymore. Virtually all supermarkets themselves either deliver or there's a service that yeah. they subscribe to.
And, we can check 80% of the stuff they have now is partially made anyway,
right,
like
exactly.
a frozen pizza or whatever.
So you don't have to worry about the heat. You don't have to worry about whatever it is we've talked about. This doesn't make you nervous? I mean, maybe it's just change that's making me nervous. But
I'll be home reading the great books.
No, there you go. So that to me is also the interesting thing, because if you look, we talked about, okay, look at the last 100 years. Well, the last 100 years has been the story of convenience, things that freed you up to do other things. But if you ask anybody what their problem is in life, almost everybody will say, I'm too busy, I have no time.
Right.
So I think the question is, well, how is that possible? How did we get here where you half your food is takeout and you didn't have to make it? And you know, you might have a Roomba and you have almost everybody has a dishwasher in their house. How is that possible? Well, a lot of it is we've filled things up with, we go online, we tweet, we find other things to do. And I think, you know, Jim, as you say, if you want to still get out there and chop wood or walk around,
I've done
the, walk
wood
around
chopping
the lake
in my time. Me and Ronald Reagan used to go out in the fields.
Yeah,
you know, but the great line,
lovely.
I know she wasn't talking about dishwashing when Joni Mitchell said, you don't know what you got till it's gone.
Exactly.
But I mean, you know, and you know, I don't know if you just said this because I was just looking at my notes, Kara, but, you know, the dishwasher. Whenever, I don't know when it was invented or when it happened. The dishwasher was essentially the invention you're talking about for next year, let's say 40 years ago
right,
or 50
right,
years
right,
ago.
Right, right.
Essentially, you only
mm-hmm.
wash it. We don't have to wash dishes anymore.
Right.
All we do is rinse them off and we put them in this box that and hit a button.
They're wonderful.
And now you don't have to do that. So how Marjorie asked you this in vis-a-vis, I don't know whether it was the umbrella or whatever it was. How close are we to the point, what's his name, David Rose?
Mm-hmm.
How close are we to the point when the David Rose approach to living is affordable and accessible for all of us? 5 years? 3 years? I know individual pieces are available now.
Right. And, well, I don't think it's that far away. I think like in 3 or 4 years, a lot of the pieces of this are going to be close. And I think one thing that it's going to fundamentally change that we kind of haven't talked about is that it may be that instead of going out and getting so many things, like getting a new dishwasher or whatever, that because your dishwasher is smart enough, it's essentially a computer, which is, you know,
yep.
what your cell phone is, what the Nest thermostat is, that you download an upgrade for your dishwasher. Tesla cars, and you know Tesla cars,
yes.
which are out of the reach of most of us right now, but when you have something wrong with your Tesla car, they will download a fix for it. So it'll sit
wow.
there in the garage and download its fix. I mean,
wow.
occasionally they do have to go and be seen by a person. But I think we may be entering an era where instead of going and getting a better refrigerator, you download the next refrigerator.
What's this?
The Which
end,
I think is kind
of
cool.
The Maytag repairman.
No, never.
Is no more.
Are there Maytag repairmen?
I don't
and
know.
And the crack that goes with it.
I think
with
he
it.
May
that's
have already left the scene.
Either of you ever seen Wallace and Gromit, one of the greatest claymations?
Oh, my God.
I mean, that's
yes.
essentially
Your
like 10 years ago what this
it.
Was. The guy, you've never seen Wallace and Gromit?
Like once.
Oh my God.
I used to watch all the
his
time.
His bed comes up. He slides into his clothes. He then falls through, goes through a tube onto the first floor. His toast is buttered by some machine. Essentially, this is what Wallace
well,
is. Gromit is the dog, by the way. And if you haven't ever seen it
oh,
out
God,
there,
they're great.
And you don't need kids for this. It is as funny and clever as anything ever. I'm sorry.
One of the cool projects going on at MIT that literally could, in a very positive way, change how we live is thinking about if you're only wealthy enough to afford a 400 square foot place, let's say in Boston, but mm-hmm. you want to live in Boston, how do you turn that from, you know, 9 to 5, a workspace, and then 5 to, you know, 6 in the morning, a space where there's a bed bed and, you know, a place to eat and whatever. And they're really thinking about how do you create this sort of smart furniture that can move around and can do different things. And that actually, when you think about all these conversations we have about affordable housing, how can the middle class afford to live in Boston anymore? Well, if you had a 500 square foot place and it changed all the time, so it was your living room and it was your bedroom and it was a home office in a way that worked for you.
That's neat.
Kind of cool, right?
That's neat. Marjorie puts a damper on all this. She just emailed. She said, we'll be spending all our time trying to figure out how these things work.
I was going to say about you. Is she talking about you or is she talking about herself?
She's talking about herself. But I'm right with you, Marjorie. Two Marjories in the same boat.
Yeah, but do you have any trouble figuring out how your dishwasher works? Well, maybe you do, but
I have trouble figuring
even
out lots
Kara
of things.
Even Kara is joining into the...
No, but I think a lot of things that are well-made... Your smartphone, people don't have any trouble figuring out. If there's done well, they should be easy. The innovation
eventually
should be easy. That should be the idea.
Eventually. You got a great thing. While we have time, I want to have a second to talk about. What do you got going on tonight in Innovation?
So,
this sounds fantastic.
Tonight, we're actually talking to two researchers doing this thing called the Longevity Project. So back in the 1920s, a bunch of kids, 1,500 kids, were entered into this thing called the Longevity Project. And the idea was to track them for the rest of their lives and figure out who lived a long time and who didn't and why. And generations of researchers, of course, have had to follow these kids. One's 103 now. But, you know, and these kids as they lived their lives. And they found the most incredible things. So I'll tell you a couple of counterintuitive things. One really counterintuitive thing they found is that the kids who were optimistic early on in their lives, they didn't tend to live very long.
Really?
Yeah. It was the kids.
Their hopes were dashed.
Right. It was the kid. That's right. It was the kids who were like prudent, who made a plan B, who sort of made lists, all that kind of thing, who ended up doing really well. And the other thing was physical exercise turned out to be really good, but it didn't matter what you did. So like gardening was pretty much just as good as running.
Really?
Yep. And
wow.
So anyway, we talk about a whole bunch of things that came out of this study, and a lot of it really contradicts that sort of conventional wisdom.
How about butter and chocolate?
They didn't test it. I know. I asked that too.
Okay.
I'm all for buttered chocolate.
Marjorie has been on a
butter.
Lifelong butter and chocolate diet.
I have.
I know. I have too.
You've done very
cream.
Well with it, Marjorie. Kara, what's the Saturday deal?
This Saturday, we're actually talking, speaking of food, we're actually talking about seafood, the science of seafood, how it gets to your plate. Some of it's a little bit jarring, but that's what we're talking about.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Okay.
Kara, it's great
Kara
to see
Miller
you.
Is the host of Innovation Hub. She's going to have a smart house very soon and invite us all over for dinner. You can catch her tonight at 9 and Saturday mornings at 10. Thanks so much, Kara. That was
Thanks,
a great
Marjorie.
Segment.
Thanks, Jim.
Up next, Governor Charlie Baker joins us to take our questions and yours. It's the first time he's going to be here as governor of the Commonwealth. His inaugural on Ask the Governor is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Kick off the noon hour of Boston Public Radio with a frequent guest, but in a new capacity. Charlie Baker joins us. The new governor will be with us and you from noon to one on his first monthly Ask the Governor. You can call, email, or send your questions to hashtag AskBaker.
Harvard Business School's Michael Norton has new research that shows how most of us trust our random thoughts, our first impressions, and even our dreams more than carefully and deliberately considered ideas. Then Jared Bowen gives us his analysis of the 2015 Oscar picks. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Welcome to hour number two of Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. He is Jim Browder. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, and it's his first time as governor.
No, he's his first time as governor here in Studio 3 for the first of many monthly editions. A guy who is barely sworn in and has already implemented the four-day work week. Congratulations on that, Governor
Baker. Some things just can't wait.
How are you feeling, Governor
Baker?
Man,
oh, man, what a tough crowd.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. I think I was mostly tired. But my big concern, to tell you the truth, was I started to feel really sick on Monday. It got worse on Tuesday. And my thought was I could hang around here and infect everyone, go to the mayor's, state of the city, and every single person I met would be have an opportunity to be infected by me, or I could just go home and get out of the way and do the public health appropriate thing to do, which I did. And I went to bed at about 5 o'clock on Tuesday and got up about 3 o'clock Wednesday afternoon.
Oh, there you go. So, there you go. Well, that, well, you look pretty good,
but I'm
Charlie
much better
Baker.
Now. Much
oh, good.
Better.
Well, I'm glad you're much better now. Yeah. So before we talk about policy and everything else, issues, I mean, this is going to be a pretty heady time for you. I mean, we all saw you march up the steps at the State House with your wife and your three adorable kids and put your hand on the Bible. What was it like for you that day? I know your dad was in the audience. Your mom couldn't be there. It must have been just, I mean, you can get a little emotional, Charlie. You held it together, though.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Marjorie. I really am a people person. What I would say is that the whole thing was, on some level, some of it was familiar. I mean, I spent 8 years working for Bill Weld and Paul Cellucci. I'm certainly familiar with the building and some of the pomp that comes with it. But to be in the middle of it and to be part of it was obviously unique and different. But for me, the stuff that really resonated, the stuff that sort of stayed with me were the people that I saw who were friends or neighbors or people I'd known for a really long time as I wandered my way in and around the State House. And by the way, the doing that thing inside as opposed to outside because of the weather conditions, I actually think made it a little more intimate and in some ways maybe better than it might have been if we did it on the long walk up Park Street. The second thing I would say is that, you know, for my dad and for me, it was particularly special because, and I'm, of course, terribly sorry that my mom couldn't be there, but you know, my parents were always big civic people to begin with, and I grew up in a house where that stuff really mattered, and I know for my dad it was a really big deal, and for my kids especially, it was a chance for them to see that dad followed through on something that was important to him.
Yeah.
And so I guess what I would say is, amidst all of the stuff that went on, the stuff that really sticks with me is the really personal stuff. I mean, my favorite picture from the whole thing was a picture somebody took of Lauren and me dancing that night at the convention to Stand By Me, which was our wedding song. We got married 27 years ago. And it's just a solo black and white photo of the two of us, and there's really nothing around us, and it's just us. And for me, anyway, that's kind of the most important part.
Hey, Charlie, you mentioned Governor Baker, you mentioned the kids. How the kids reacting to their father being the governor? I mean, your kids, your daughter was in, obviously, your first commercial that was much talked about. Caroline, is that not her name? And how did your kids react?
Star of the show.
As of, I'd say that's fair. As of Thursday night, or Thursday afternoon, their father's the governor. How are they dealing with that?
I think for them it's, I should ask them. I think the big thing for them is it's a new experience and we'll see how it plays out over time. I mean, my kids are a lot older, so it makes a big difference. I mean, Charlie lives and works in Virginia. Caroline is a senior in high school and will be off to college next year. And AJ's already back at Union where he's a junior. So I think for my kids it's a slightly different exercise than it would be, for example, for Karen Polito's kids who are 10 and 8.
Yeah. You know, I should mention, in case people don't know, the reason your mom couldn't be there is your mom's suffering from Alzheimer's, and she knew that you ran the first time around, but she was not aware that you had run at all the second time around, and not aware that you had won.
Not aware. It's always hard to tell when you get to a certain point with Alzheimer's. The way my dad would describe it is to say that a lot of the people at the nursing facility where my mom resides were very excited about the fact that there was an election and that I won. And the hubbub was pretty obvious to everybody. And my dad said that he had a long talk with my mom about it. And I think she knows that something big happened, but I'd be hard-pressed to think she knows what that big thing is, which is obviously bittersweet for me and for him and for my brothers and those who know my mom, because I am very much my mother's son. But you know what? who I am and what I'm about, a big part of that has been embedded into me by my mother for a very long time, whether she actually understood what happened on Inauguration Day or not.
That's the voice of Charlie Baker. He's been here many a time, but this is the first time as the governor of the Commonwealth. He'll be with you and us monthly. He's going to take your calls in a second at 877-301-8970. The lines are obviously full. You can tweet him. The hashtag is AskBaker. You can email at bprwgbh.org. And we should say right up front, any email, tweet, or a thing like that or call that the governor doesn't get to, his office will get the information and they will respond. Before we get to the calls, Charlie Baker, what do you think of the protest this morning on 93?
I'm a big believer in the right to protest, and I think peaceful protest is an important part of who we are as a country. But I think tying up traffic and putting cement barrels down in the middle of the highway at the height of rush hour on two of the most important arteries in and out of the city of Boston is a bad idea. And I do know of at least one ambulance that had to be diverted and find a different way into Boston as a result of the protests. And I think that sort of disruption is sort of above and beyond. And the folks, I believe, were appropriately arrested. And that was the right thing to do.
Want to take some calls, Governor Baker?
Certainly.
All there for you.
Okay, let's talk to Lynette from East Bridgewater.
It's Linnell, actually.
Linnell.
Hi, okay. Linnell. How are you?
Hi, good. Thank you so much, Governor, for taking my call. I'm so proud to call you Governor Baker. Congratulations on your win, and thank you so much for wanting to address our heroin epidemic head on. I really appreciate that. Coming from a mom of a heroin addict who's been struggling for 7 years. But I'd like to know, I know that you are starting a task force, and I want to say thank you again for that, too. I just want to know how the public is going to have access to that task force, if there are going to be any public forums in which those that are actually living in the grips of addiction and those that are feeling the effects, caring for someone, a loved one, is going to be able to advocate for what we need and what we see as the problem in the front lines. I know a lot of people that are on the task force are people that work in the programs. I'm just concerned that other task force in the past haven't really done the public outreach that I think can make some real good change.
You know, Linnell, first of all, God bless for what you're dealing with and what you've been working through. And thank you very much for your interest in this. One of the things that's happened since I first brought this issue up shortly after the election is we've heard from a lot of people around the Commonwealth who are involved in both formal and informal groups around addiction generally and heroin and opiates in particular. And that's made us think that it's going to be important for us to put together an opportunity for people like you and others to have a voice. And so I think what you're likely to see us do, and we talked about this actually for a while this morning, is to put together a small group of people who have been involved in this issue and then have them engage in a broader public discussion to collect input and thoughts and ideas and observations from people around the Commonwealth. And that process will probably take, I don't want it to take too long because it's one of these things where I would like to move quickly, but at the same time, I want to give people a chance to speak out. So my guess is we'll probably have a task force announced sometime soon. It won't be a big one. It's going to be relatively small, but it will reach out and communicate and have hearings and public conversations with people around the Commonwealth over the course of probably the next couple of months. And we'll certainly make sure we do one in your living room in East Bridgewater. How's that?
Linnell, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Okay. Governor Baker, one quick follow-up on that, it made a lot of news. Evan Green, 19-year-old young man from Easton, died about a year ago, and you mentioned him in your inaugural, and his parents were very, very moved that you did. But you made a mistake about his starting on drugs from prescriptions to not – I guess he got them from his friends initially. So how'd that happen?
Obviously, I made a mistake. Won't happen again. My big issue with that was more that it's Evans and John and Stephanie Green's story. And I hated discovering that I got their story wrong, first of all. And then secondly, I would hate to have the fact that I got some of the facts wrong detract from the larger issue. And I happen to believe that the response I got in the chamber that day, which was a standing ovation to the conversation about moving forward on this, and the response that I've gotten generally when I've talked about this issue overall doesn't get lost in all this. The overwhelming sense I get from this issue There are no class lines to it. There are no geography lines to it. This is something that affects people from one end of Massachusetts to the other. We were looking at some data the other day. I think there are close to 1,000 deaths in 2013 attributable to heroin overdoses. 1,000 or opiate overdoses. That's way more than people die in highway fatalities, just to pick one example. And I think the big issue for the Greens, and certainly for me, is that we move forward and do something on both the front end of this with respect to prevention, and as well as thinking a little differently about what we do with regard to treatment.
Shelley Baker, you've been a manager for much of your life. Obviously, everybody knows about Harvard Pilgrim. Now you're the governor. You ran ANF. You ran Health and Human Services. I don't know if it was a staff screw-up or not vetting something or your fault. How do you deal when there's a mistake that's made under you that actually comes out through you in any of those capacities? Are you a screamer? Do you call people on the carpet? How do you deal with that on a staff level?
I don't think I'm a screamer, but you'd have to ask the people who work with me if they think I'm a screamer.
What are you?
I'm sort of a one strike person. I mean, I give everybody the benefit of the doubt, but I would hate to make the same mistake twice. So we'll obviously make sure that sort of thing never happens again.
Let's go back to
good
the calls.
Thing. I'm not working for you.
Governor Governor Charlie Baker, we'll go back to the lines.
Gavin from Lynn next door.
Yes, good Gavin. Afternoon, Governor. Welcome and congratulations.
How are you, sir?
Yes, I'm from Lynn, and playing on the other side of the team. I've been a Democrat for many, many years. You know, in the spirit of what's going on...
No, my mom is a Democrat, by the way, just...
You know, I was wondering, she seemed pretty compassionate.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Yes, sir. You know what's going on in Washington, I'm really looking forward and really paying attention to how we can show Washington how to do things differently with two different teams. You know, that's supposed to be the way it works and very healthy. And in the spirit of that, you know, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the bill from Senator Eldridge and Representative Atkins, the People Act, you know, in response to Citizens United decision. I was hoping that maybe somehow in the spirit of bipartisanship, you know, this is an issue right here on the North Shore where 70% of the people who go out and vote support, you know, redefining corporations as corporations and people as people. And I was hoping that maybe in the spirit of bipartisanship that you could come out and embrace this act and this bill that's being introduced actually today or tomorrow and find out where you stand on corporations being given all the rights that citizens are granted.
We got it, Kevin. Thank you very much for the call.
You know, I will certainly review that bill when it comes out. One of the things we need to be I think there's way too much financial influence in politics generally, and I think anything we can do to make it a more transparent and more accountable process is a good thing. But the devil is very much in the details of this stuff. If you look back over the last 25 years of campaign finance reform, I think most people would say it has not succeeded at its intended task, which is to make money less relevant in elections and in politics. And I think that's partly a function of the fact that in the details, some of the intent always gets lost. And I think part of it's also a function of the fact that The First Amendment is held to a very you really have to cross a really high bar to get over the First Amendment issue when it comes to freedom of speech, which is frankly kind of as it should be, whether you're, you know, the Sierra Club or the Heritage Foundation.
Gavin, thanks for the call.
We're talking with Governor Charlie Baker. Charlie, one of the other things you made a big deal about in your inaugural address and on the campaign as well was the achievement gap. I know you've obviously got budget constraints, but could you tell us a couple of things that you're thinking about doing differently than Governor DeVault Patrick along those lines for people that are very concerned about education and that gap?
Well, I think one of the things we've talked a lot about, and we're going to continue to uphold that, is a commitment to support local aid to cities and towns, which is the primary mechanism through which the state supports local communities when it comes to education. I think one of the other things we're going to do is try to incorporate what I would call learning opportunities with respect to best practices. One of the places we visited during our four-day sort of inaugural celebration, which included a segment that we called Spotlight on Excellence, was we went up to Lawrence and visited the Frost K through 8 school. And the reason we went to the Frost K through 8 school is because it's in Lawrence, and it's a level one school. Dealing with all the issues and all the circumstances and all the situations that you would expect to find in a city that has plenty of problems. But that school is performing, and it's doing a terrific job. And there are many examples of that all over the Commonwealth. And we should be learning from what those people are up to and what they're doing and sharing that learning with other people so that they can get better as well. I don't think we tend to operate in pods. You know, if you're in Lowell, Lawrence might as well be on, you know, Lawrence is far away, okay? And somehow we have to figure out how to create a more unified approach to sharing and collaborating around what works.
Speaking of local aid, Charlie Baker, you said in the campaign one of your first acts would be to release an additional $100 million in local aid. You did it.
It's actually in Chapter 90 money, which is different than local aid.
Okay, Chapter 90 to cities and towns. You also implemented a hiring freeze as a way to deal with on the budget, just for a second. Deval Patrick, I think, on the way out said he thinks there's a $329 million hole. He filled part of it, not all of it. At the other extreme, the outgoing head of the Mass Taxpayers Foundation, Mike Widmer, says it's $1 billion. One, listen to that response. Where do you think it is, Charlie? Do you have any idea?
It's just funny how,
how far apart everybody can be.
Yeah.
Do you have any guess? Do you have any educated guesses as to how big the hole is?
I mean, this is a hard question to answer until you actually sit in some of the chairs. So we've been at this now for 4 or 5 days. I would expect that by the time we talk about by the time we're talking about this next week, we'll have sort of a hard estimate of our own and a set of plans with respect to what to do about it.
Are you still as convinced as you were?
Think it's at least $500 million. Just
$500 million left to do.
Yeah.
Are you as convinced as you were as a candidate that a no fee, no tax, new tax solution exists to fill in that hole?
I think we have to start there. I mean, from my point of view, I heard a lot of messages on the campaign trail, but one of the biggest ones I heard was, don't keep nickel and diming me every time I turn around. I have to live with my budget every year. I have to live with my wages. Commonwealth of Mass, you should do the same. And I think that's where we should start, period.
When you say start, I was interviewed Stan Rosenberg last night, who had wonderful things to say about you. I know you knew each other when you were both doing budgetary things at the State House. He's now the new Senate.
Now we're doing budgetary things again.
At a different level at the State House. He said a variation on what you said. He said taxes, absolute last resort. I think there are other things that can be done, that sort of thing. You just said that's the starting place, trying to figure out how to do it. Does that mean that you're more open potentially to those issues, enhancement, as the saying goes, or no?
I'm not open to raising taxes to deal with a budget deficit that was started by a budget that began, you know, less than 12 months ago. I mean, come on, people. Folks built a budget. They signed off it in June. We should be able to figure this out.
Governor Baker, here's a question from email. This is from Jim from Shrewsbury. Anyway, here's what he says. What plans do you have for bringing broadband internet to underserved communities in western Massachusetts? I live less than 20 minutes from UMass and Amherst, but here where I live, we have no broadband service, no cell service, no cable, no DSL, no nothing. It's like living in a third world country. I didn't even realize this was so.
I can promise you that's probably not Shrewsbury, which is next to Worcester.
It must be Shrewsbury.
Yeah. Okay.
Forgive me.
I know the administration has plans or had plans moving forward to deal with that issue, and we're certainly going to pick those up and continue to pursue them. I do think one of the big questions that's an important one to investigate on this is the changing nature of technology generally. I wonder if there's a wireless solution for more rural areas that would be as effective as broadband.
Yeah.
The answer to that may be no, okay? But if the answer to that is yes, it might be worth pursuing that as well.
Have you noticed that people are much nicer to you now than they were 4 days ago?
You know, I used to joke that I hadn't met anybody who didn't vote for me after the election. I think people. I think everybody likes a new beginning. You know, kind of no matter who it is that's part of it. I just happen to be part of it this time. My own view is that I'm sure along the way, in the course of dealing with budgets and the business of governing and all the rest, I'm going to make some people really happy and some people not so happy. My hope is that over time, people will come to believe that we tried to make the decisions based on the best information that was available. And I think if you look at the people we've appointed to serve in our administration, they cut across a pretty broad swath of the political spectrum. And it would be pretty hard to argue that that we sort of got up in the morning and said we were going to pick everybody on this side of the ledger instead of that side, because generally speaking, the men and women we've brought in at a senior leadership position cut across a pretty broad political spectrum. And I hope we end up governing in a way that demonstrates to people that we are trying to be practical first.
So speaking of that, I was going to bring this up later, but since you brought it up, one of your most recent appointments is your environmental person, transportation person, Stephanie Pollack, who told me a year ago she was a big supporter of a gas tax increase and the governor's billion-dollar infrastructure and transportation thing. What kind of conversation do you have with someone like that who has a totally different perspective, at least on that one piece of the action?
Well, you certainly talk about it, and we did. And obviously that was something where, you know, I'm the governor, so by definition the policy emanates out of our office with respect to those very high-level issues. But I'll tell you this. I met with Stephanie three or four times at the suggestion of several people who knew her, and with every meeting became more and more impressed with her knowledge of transportation and transit issues generally, the creativity that she brings to thinking about them with respect to what we can do going forward, and her desire to be involved in what everybody agrees is going to be a very tough and difficult set of decisions. I think she's going to be terrific, and I'm already taking a lot of grief from a lot of my friends on the right side of the aisle about it, but I came away thinking, having talked to a lot of people, that she was by far the most qualified person for the job, and the right person for the job.
One of my incorrect predictions, which continues a long string, is that Richard Tessay would have a major role in the Baker administration. He was your running mate last time, ran two great races for Congress. Yep. Did you talk to him?
Sure. Richard and I had several conversations, and I think for him, he's looking to do something that's a little less public sector related, which... if you think about it, Richard was on the ballot in 2010. He was on the ballot in 2012. He was on the ballot in 2014. I think he's probably looking to spend some time doing something that's not quite so public, which, you know, on some level, I don't blame him.
That is the voice of the new governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Charlie Baker. Governor Baker is with us to the top of the hour, taking our questions and yours. You can also email him at bpr@wgbh.org or tweet him at #AskBaker. Ask the Governor continues at 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio till 1 o'clock.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We are spending an hour, which we will do every month, with a new governor of the Commonwealth. He is Charlie Baker. He's here to take your calls, your emails, your tweets, and all those sorts of things.
You know, we were just talking, we were talking about offices, and it's been a lot of stories about offices in the paper because you moved your office from the big, huge, very ornate, you know, the gold stuff and the beautiful drapes and stuff like that in Governor Patrick's office. You felt uncomfortable there, and you moved to a much more kind of regular old boring office. So I assume that was because you
regular
felt uncomfortable there, or was it because,
as
I think the Globe reported, that you were taken, this wasn't about a swipe at Governor Patrick, was it?
No, it was not meant as a swipe at anybody. The governor's suite itself is a whole bunch of offices, okay, including the corner office that is the governor's office, which is a very historical piece of work. And it's gorgeous. I mean, the photos of it, people have seen
it.
It's a beautiful space. But I've never had an office where I couldn't hang pictures of my family and my kids and stupid stuff that I've done across my career.
What stupid stuff do you want to hang pictures of?
I've done a lot,
Your athletic events?
Throwing my kids up in the air. I mean,
the usual
stuff that dads do, I think. But there's absolutely no way I could put any of that stuff. I mean, the stuff that belongs on the walls and in that office are historical. I mean, if you look at most of the prints that are on the wall in that office now, they're on loan from the MFA. I mean, they're gorgeous.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I would love to figure out some way, and I've said this before, I would love to figure out some way for the public to get more of a look at this and to get a look at the space. Because it is beautiful, okay? But, you know, if you're going to have a meeting with five or six people to talk about some, you know, pick an issue, the opiate stuff, just to pick one, I would much rather be in an office where I'm surrounded by pictures of my wife and my kids and And where if somebody knocks a cup of coffee on the floor, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah,
and,
it's not a big deal. You can eat sandwiches and stuff
and,
like that.
And yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
And where at the end of the day, you know, it looks like an office looks like at the end of the day. People have put their feet up on the tables. I mean, there's just – that's kind of the way I am. And
yeah.
This was not meant at all to have anything to do with the prior governor. It really wasn't. It was more like –
so you can make a mess, mayonnaise everywhere, potato chips
yeah.
everywhere. It's not a big deal.
And you know, and we will certainly use – the governor's office for visits and guests and ceremonial purposes and all that stuff. But the work of sitting around and chewing the fat on some important thing that we're trying to figure out where people have their feet up on the desk and are sucking on sodas. And I want that to be in more of a traditional office type environment.
Okay.
Let's go back to the Coles, Governor Charlie Baker.
How about Mike and Everett?
Hello, Mike.
Governor Baker, thank you for having me on. I would just like to know your opinion on whether or not Boston should be able to host a citywide vote on the Olympics. Mayor Walsh's hypocrisy on having one plus have a vote in Charlestown and not allowing Boston to vote to spend $5 billion is very interesting to me, and I just wanted to hear your opinion on that. And real quickly, I'm glad that protesters held their protest this morning because Steve Wynn will be in Boston today, and Marty Walsh would claim that it was a host community if he spent more time on Route 93 today getting over to the convention center this afternoon.
Thanks for your editorial, Mike. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was pretty interesting. I think we have rules and laws and regulations in place with respect to referendums. And if people want to collect signatures to support referendums, they can do that. And I'm a big believer in the referendum process. I always have been. And if people want to collect the signatures and do the work associated with putting a referendum on the ballot, either on a statewide basis or a citywide basis, they are free to do so. I mean, we've got the process in place, and people can choose to take it. But part of the point behind making people collect signatures and engage in that civic endeavor, if they want to put something on the ballot, is to determine whether or not, in fact, there is any level of support for it. I mean, I've participated, as Jim knows better than anybody, in a lot of referendum questions, and I participated in some where we got the signatures and got it on the ballot, and I participated in some where we didn't. And in the cases where we didn't, I think that was a statement made by the public that they didn't think whatever it was I was advocating for belonged on the ballot. So I think that whole process is actually designed to separate the stuff people really want to vote on from the stuff they don't.
Governor, one last thing on the Olympics, if I just can for a second. We've had endless discussions here with everybody from Mayor Walsh to John Fish to Dan O'Connell, everybody. Everybody says we're not going to spend any public money other than that which is already in the pipeline. And I assume you'd like that to be the outcome too, correct?
Yeah, sure.
Could you explain to us, when Marty Walsh says, trust me, this is not going to happen, and everybody says that, how does one guarantee that we don't have – I mean, for example, London, they estimated that the cost would be almost exactly what the cost is estimated to be here, somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 billion. It mushroomed to roughly 15. Despite, let's assume, his goodwill across the board everywhere, how do we know – how do the taxpayers know that 10 years from now they're not handed a $10 billion bill?
Well, I think part of that is there's going to be an open process here. And the way I think about this process is just starting now, okay? I mean, the process the USOC went through, the United States Olympic Committee, basically was to pick a place to engage the debate and the development of a real project plan that would then become the item that you would put as sort of the equivalent of a bid book before the International Olympic Committee 2 years from now. So there's a tremendous amount of planning that has to go into the process over the course of the next couple of years, and that will be a pretty transparent and public process, which, frankly, I'm looking forward to as well. I mean, I was a private citizen until a week ago, so I don't have a lot of access to what's been discussed with the U.S. Olympic Committee either, and I'm looking forward to being brought into that conversation.
Have you read the bid, by the way? Have you seen
it? No, I haven't seen the bid.
So is it conceivable at the end of this public process that a Governor Charlie Baker would determine this is not affordable, I'm not going to support this thing?
Well, I'm thinking about it the other way around, Jim, which is that it's important that it be something that people believe can work financially. The other thing I would say is I found Shirley Leung's column. Now, sometimes when Shirley writes for the Globe, she's not always writing on stuff that that puts me in a very favorable light. But she did write a piece where she talked to the guy who ran the New York Olympic
bid
process,
which
I thought was
column.
Really interesting. Yeah. I mean, she basically said what I've said from the beginning of this, which is the planning exercise and the endeavor associated with thinking about your city in 20-year increments can yield some real benefits. And the big thrust of the story that came out of the New York experience was they lost to London, but they got huge opportunities to do things that they never would have gotten otherwise because they never would have imagined them. And I think we should all recognize that there's a silver lining to this around the planning activity that's important.
So in other words, Charlie Baker, Governor Baker, I should say, now that you're the governor, Governor Baker, is that we can plan and plan and plan and then hope we lose.
That's certainly one way of thinking about it, okay. Marjorie.
Let's go back to the calls. Governor Baker, please.
I would prefer to think that we're going to win, to tell you the truth, just because I'm kind of built more that way.
Governor.
Why don't we talk to Patrick?
You're in Charlestown, Patrick. You're on with Governor Baker. Hi.
Hi, Governor Baker. How are you?
I'm good, sir. How are you?
Good. So I've been reading about your three-day back and forth with Secretary of State Bill Galvin about rescinding Governor Patrick's appointment.
Yep.
And I was just wondering if you're planning on taking responsibility if the mix-up ends up adversely affecting the Hernandez trial down in Bristol County.
Well, first of all, Patrick, it won't affect the Hernandez trial in Bristol County. I can promise you that. Secondly, we were stuck in kind of a tough spot. No documentation, no knowledge, very little information shortly after we took office with respect to who actually had been appointed during that final frenzy. And rather than lose the 3 or 4 days that it was going to take before people could give us access to some of the information that had been archived, we wrote a very simple one-line note that said if somebody had been appointed in the recent 15-day period, then that appointment was rescinded. And we believe the governor's appointment was an acting appointment. The governor believes his appointment was – this is Governor Patrick – believes his appointment of Quinn, Tom Quinn, was an acting appointment, and so do we. And I think for all intents and purposes, the Hernandez trial is moving forward as it should, and we don't believe that anything we've done disrupts that at all. But we do believe that we need to make a decision with respect to the appointment of a permanent DA in Bristol County soon.
How imminent is that, Charlie Baker?
Say
how imminent is that?
I certainly think it needs to be by the end of the week.
And just so people understand, this 15-day thing is not an arbitrary thing. Governors, new governors, have the power to rescind unilaterally.
Under certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. It only applies – see, this was the problem is we all the information associated with all the appointments that the Patrick administration made toward the end of the term had all been archived, okay? So we showed up and there's literally nothing. Nothing in the file cabinets, nothing. And so we asked the Secretary of State to give us guidance and information on who, in fact, was in that pipeline. And he said, well, we can give it to you, but it's been archived, so it's going to have to take until Monday. Well, Monday would have been 3 days after we were asking for it, which would have meant 3 more days would have been lost. And since we didn't know who had been appointed, we didn't know which ones were appointed under the terms associated with that 15-day rescission or not. Not every appointment that's made in the last 15 days applies. There are certain, it only applies to get way into the weeds and probably far beyond where any of your listeners would ever want to go. The only ones for which that 15-day rescission applies are ones that are associated with positions that used to be confirmed by the Governor's Council. Once upon a time.
Do you think that the reason they were unavailable in archives was there an attempt by the prior governor to insulate his appointments so you couldn't repeal them or you wouldn't repeal them?
I'm not going to put any motive on it. I think they probably there's probably a good case to be made that they were simply sort of cleaning up, right? And at the end of the term, wanted to have that information sent to the appropriate place where it would belong. Again, I'm not. Our effort here was not to do anything to derail the acting appointment that was made by Governor Patrick with the DA in Bristol County, and we don't believe we did.
Back to the phones, Governor Charlie Baker.
How about Chris?
Chris, you're in Foxborough. You're on with Governor Baker. Hi.
Hi. Congratulations,
Chris. You got a big weekend coming up down there, huh?
Yeah, we do.
I bet you're really looking.
From last weekend.
Yeah, I bet you're really looking forward to the traffic and the noise and the. And the public displays of affection and all the rest. Yeah.
Hey, I'm just enough outside of the stadium that it doesn't affect me. So, bring it on. My question to you, sir, is Long Island. Long Island was closed. There were 700 beds that have been lost and not been replaced. I know that there is a new shelter opening up shortly with 30 beds. Correct me if I'm wrong. But they're male beds. They're not female beds. And there's nothing being replaced for the people that are addicts that were on Long Island as well. And if they were taken care of, it has pushed kids like mine. I have two out of my five kids that are addicts. I have one that is homeless, and I have one that's incarcerated. They can't get in. They're doing the spin dry, and they can't get into the next step of the help that they need to become sober because there are no beds. I go out with a group that was started back in October, and we go out once a month, and we hand out warm clothes and some food and phone numbers for detoxes and help and everything else. We go out once a month. We went out last month, December 28th, and we saw more women than men, and it was very alarming. And the reason that we saw more women than men is because there are more men beds than woman beds. That really needs to be addressed.
Hey, Thank you.
Hey, Chris, I want you to do something before you hang up. I don't know if
we can do what you
would
want.
I would like somebody to collect some information from her so we can reach out to her.
Chris, when the governor is finished, we'll put you on hold, and one of our colleagues will take your number and information, so don't go away. I'm sorry, Governor.
The Long Island shelter issue, which was exacerbated by the failure of the bridge over to Long Island to continue to be deemed traversable, is an issue that the city and the state have been working on for the past few months. And I guess what I would say to Chris is that I will renew that as part of my conversation with the mayor. I've had several conversations with him. I've had several conversations with people. This was all during the transition, with people who are working the shelter system in the city of Boston. Her information is a little different than some of the information I've gotten, so I just want to have a chance to cue that up with some of the people that I've been talking to. I do think the larger issue she raised, which also touched on this issue of addiction, is one that we plan to deal with, as we talked about earlier, through some of the work we're going to try to do, especially with respect to heroin and opiates.
Chris, hold on. Don't go away. Stay on hold, and we will take your number. Governor, let's go back to the phones.
Lauren.
Lauren, hello.
Hi there. Geez, after that last call, I feel like mine is kind of trivial, but I assure you I'm a single businesswoman and a single sole operation, so it really is important to me. But my question is this, and I couldn't find it anywhere else. With regard to health care, I'm paying, you know, an arm and a leg because I'm the guy in the middle in the truck. But I also manage my finances so that I pay my bills sort of up front and make sure that they're paid. If I pay an entire year of premiums, am I supposed to get a little bit of a discount because they have the use of that money for the year?
I don't know the answer. I mean, I'm a health insurance guy. I should know the answer to this one. I don't know the answer to that one. I've not heard before. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, that's one where I would want us to again, take down your number and follow up on it. I know when you buy other kinds of services, if you pay a year in advance, you can get a discount off what you would otherwise pay. I don't know under state insurance law if you're allowed to do that. I'd be happy to look into it for you, though.
Lauren, can you stick around again? We'll go on hold, and your number information will be given to the governor's office. Our number is 877-301-8970. Charlie Baker, if I can just run through quickly a couple of questions asked in the email. You, years ago, were against Cape Wind. Subsequently, you said that it's a done deal, so it's fine. Is it now an undone deal in light of the fact that National Grid, and I think it's Northeast Utilities, say that they're not going to be buying power from Cape Wind? Is it done?
I think the answer is it's not clear. There's obviously a legal dispute now between Northeast Utilities and National Grid, which were buying about half of the power of Cape Wind and basically providing the certainty associated with that project that would make it possible for it to get its financing. Now, that contract or that agreement was signed, I think, 4 years ago, long time ago, mm-hmm. and Cape Wind therefore had 4 years to put its financing together, and it had until 12/31/14 as a drop dead date to demonstrate that it was moving forward with construction and all the rest, which it apparently didn't do. The utilities canceled their contract because of that. Cape Wind is arguing a force majeure provision, which is that there were unforeseen circumstances above and beyond their control. That's a legal issue that's going to get processed out here. But I certainly think that, from my point of view, that's an issue for the courts to decide. That's not an issue for us to decide. I continue to want to support renewable proposals. I'm a big fan of the onshore wind projects that have bid on that have been competitively bid with Northeast Utilities and National Grid out of Maine. I'm a big fan of accessing Canadian hydro, which I think there's a big opportunity for the New England region to work together on. And I'm a big fan of continuing to do things that reduce our carbon footprint. But this one at this point is a legal proceeding between two parties that needs to be resolved.
Let's go back to the phones. Charlie Baker is with us and you until 1 o'clock at 877-301-8970. Governor.
Michael,
you're in Boston. You're on with Governor Charlie Baker. Hi there.
Hi, Governor. How are you?
Good. How are you, sir?
Good. So my question is pertaining to charter schools. I actually live in Boston. And the question that I had was there are a number of schools. There's actually one right up the street from me that's transitioning from a regular school to some kind of ABCD program, and that's a high school. And I was wondering, when there's a case like that, why can't there be a situation where there's a great school that's already functioning, such as Match or, you know, Latin or any other school that's doing real well, but they have, like, a small space that they're working in and be given a building from an old school that's actually failing and be able to get more kids into these schools that only have small spaces that they're working with and can't really take in the amount of kids that they want to and have to rely on lotteries and such like that.
Yeah, that's actually
a great question.
I mean, Michael, that does happen in some cases. There are school committees and school districts where charter schools are operating in what was a previously public school space, and there are other school districts where that hasn't happened. That's a decision that gets made at the school committee and at the school district level, at the local level. It's not a state-based decision, and I think the opportunity there is one that, you know, there are several communities in Massachusetts I can think of off the top of my head that have gone that way and have done that. I'm not aware of it happening, however, in Boston for whatever reason.
Michael, thank you much for the call.
Governor Baker, you talked a lot during the campaign and early on. You proposed the idea of having one casino in Massachusetts and to kind of try it and see how it works. I know since then you've talked about how the voters were pretty resounding and saying we want to go ahead with this three, you know, casinos in Massachusetts. So what's your hope what's your hope for casinos going forward?
Well, I hope they are all as they are intended to be. Okay, remember, we still have the Springfield proposal is probably the one that's farthest along, and the hope of many people, including me and a lot of people in Springfield, has been that this will help revitalize a part of that city that has been pretty much down in the dumps ever since the tornado blew through it, and bring a lot of people to that city and to that area by virtue of not just the casino, but the restaurants and the connection to the Civic Center. We'll see. That's certainly my hope. And it'll also help deal with some of the I-91 issues and the other issues as well. The two big issues for me on the Wind proposal in Everett, separate and apart from sort of the casino itself, are the Sullivan Square issue, which is one that the mayor raised in his lawsuit, which, I mean, anybody who's been through Sullivan Square appreciates
the traffic issue.
It's a big deal.
Yep.
And we're kidding ourselves if we think otherwise. And and some of the issues associated with cleaning up the site, which is a significant issue all by itself. And I think, you know, so from my point of view, big thing is, you know, that they go ahead as intended and that what is supposed to happen happens. I think the Sullivan Square thing and the cleanup issue are the two big issues facing the Wind Project. And then the third issue with respect to the southeastern part of Massachusetts is sort of the the hand we need to play here with respect to the Wampanoag proposal and another one. And we also have the slop parlor in Raynham that's on the verge of being completed as well. So my hope is that it doesn't peel away from the lottery, doesn't peel away from, you know, Main Street businesses that are nearby, and that it does have the ability, and this is something we're going to have to work on, to generate activity within the vicinity of it. I mean, the thing you worry about here is that it ends up doing just the opposite and pulling activity into it that limits the ability of the areas around these things to be successful.
Can we just stay on this for a second? I want to channel the one casino, Charlie Baker, that Marjorie was talking about a minute ago. I think we asked you this during the campaign, and I can't remember what your answer was. Would you consider, since we don't know what's going to happen in Springfield, Plainville, or Everett yet, saying to the Gaming Commission, you don't have unilateral power, but urging them not to pick a Southeast Mass casino until we see how these two casinos and the slots are doing?
I don't think so, Jim. And the only reason I say that is because I don't think it's necessarily fair to the folks in Southeastern Mass just because they came third to push them way down on the list here. I think the Gaming Commission has an assignment, and their assignment is to review best proposals available and ones that have the capacity to actually perform on whatever commitments are made. And I think they should pursue the Southeastern one the same way they've pursued the others.
One last gambling thing. All the data that has come out of legislative committees suggests that things like the lottery, which you mentioned a minute ago, sort of like Robin Hood in reverse kind of things, they're played much more heavily in places like Chelsea and Holyoke. Low-income people, it obviously provide close to, what is it, $1 billion to cities and towns, that sort of stuff. The other end of the spectrum, though, in terms of equity, and I know it's something you've talked about and care about, is a graduated income tax. And I have obviously a self-interest in this. I lost that campaign 20 years ago by a mere, I think, 42 points, actually, if I remember correctly.
This close.
It was another day, and I think we could have pulled it together, by the way. So, why should that's where the vast majority of America is. Most states, the federal government. Why shouldn't we have something that takes revenue from people to fund government in a more equitable way? Why do you oppose graduated income tax?
Because I think Massachusetts, first of all, needs to compete with many other states for jobs and economic opportunity. And for the most part, states that are succeeding are states that operate in flat tax environments, period. In addition to that, we have a graduated income tax at the federal level. I think everybody knows that. Having a state income tax that's a flat tax sitting alongside of it, I think, is the fairest and most appropriate way to deal with that. And third, if you look at where a lot of the economic growth has taken place over the course of the past decade, I mean, big-time job growth, big-time growth in wages, big-time growth in sort of population, it's in states that have a relatively low, flat income tax. And it's not – that shouldn't be lost on any of us.
Let's go back to the calls. Charlie Baker is the governor. It's his first of monthly visits to ask the governor.
Eric from Grafton's been on there for a long time. We should probably get him in here.
Hi, Eric.
Hi, Governor. I just had a question. I'm glad you're feeling better. but how do you justify taking a paid sick day yesterday? I know you had the flu and you mentioned it was the responsible thing to do, and I agree. But, you know, less than a week into your term, after you campaigned against earned sick time back in October and November.
Yeah, I didn't campaign against earned sick time per se, but I didn't support the ballot question that was before the voters. And the main reason for that is it's the broadest, most restrictive, most comprehensive earned sick time policy in the country by a wide margin. And I made a series of proposals that I thought represented something that would be A, easier to administer for small businesses especially, B, more flexible to deal with the fact that a lot of companies use a lot of different policies and approaches to earn sick time, and C, less expensive to implement, which would have meant it would be easier to enforce and more likely to be pursued. I'm a big believer in earned sick time. I just felt that that law in particular would have some unintended consequences. We're going to implement it enthusiastically and see where it goes, and I certainly hope it doesn't have some of the unintended consequences that I was concerned about. But I certainly support earned sick time and believe that Massachusetts should have earned sick time.
Charlie Baker, you're talking about charter schools a minute ago. One other education thing, Deval Patrick, shortly after he was elected, proposed free community colleges, went absolutely nowhere. The President of the United States 7 years later, proposed free community colleges just a couple of days ago. I think the way it would work, you probably know better than I, 75% of the money would be picked up by the feds if it were to pass, yep. And then a state that opted in would have to fill in the other 25% to provide a free education for a kid who wants to go to community college. If it were to become law federally, would you opt in? Is that something you'd embrace?
I'd certainly take a look at it, but obviously the devil is really in the details on that sort of thing. I mean, look at the experience we're having with the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. Supposedly 90% of the increase in coverage was going to be paid for by the feds, yet somehow we have a budget deficit that's in the hundreds of millions of dollars associated with implementing that here in Massachusetts. The other thing I would say is I continue to not understand this issue because I have a lot of friends and a lot of colleagues who work in the community college space, and almost to a person, they say the Pell Grant program covers the cost of a community college program. So I'm missing something here with respect to what the president is looking to do. I also think this is one where the devil will be in the details, and I'll be anxious to see what the actual platform is that rolls out on this after the State of the Union.
We only have a minute, so are you nervous at all about this job? You're a pretty confident guy, but you've got a pretty big. Are you nervous at all about this job?
Well, yeah. I mean,
that's right. Stakes are high. You could really blow it, Governor Baker.
You would have to be unusual, let's put it that way, to not go into a job like this with butterflies in your stomach. I mean, I'm psyched about the people we've appointed so far. I think they're an enormously talented and experienced group. That helps a little bit with the nervousness. I believe we have picked on some issues that we want to deal with straight out of the gate that are certainly important to me and important to them. That helps to some extent. But I am well aware of the full set of responsibilities that comes with having this job, and I'm grateful as I can be to being given an opportunity by the voters to do it, but I want to make sure I do it and I do it well and that we do it and we do it well. Whatever happens, I want, as I said at the beginning of this conversation, I want people 4 years from now to say, you know, the guy came prepared. He did his homework. His team did his homework, and generally speaking, they made the best decisions that they thought were appropriate for the people of the Commonwealth. I mean, yeah. So yeah,
Aren't you grateful your kids are Caroline next year will be in college, because then you have a little bit of the stress off you having to run to like soccer games or football games in the middle of the week. You know what I mean? You can like work 24/7, Charlie Baker.
I can't wait to tell my wife that. She'll be thrilled.
Yeah. Hey, before you go on that note, obviously you've talked about your appointments. Who are two or three people who don't work for you, who are, I don't know, your kitchen cat, people you really trust in the world, who when you've got a tough decision to make or you're stressed out about something, you sit down with or call on the phone to get their judgment?
Well, this will sound incredibly sort of stereotypical, but the person I typically call most of the time when I have a tough nut I need to crack is my father, who's always been the person who's given me unbelievably great advice with no edge and no point of view other than telling me what he thinks is in, you know, the larger best interest. The great thing about parents is they're really just interested in their children's success. And so you never have to worry about them coming at any question you ask them with some sort of oddball, you know, unanticipated or unspoken agenda.
Fair enough. Everybody on the line, and the lines are full, as we said, if you stay on hold, your phone number will be conveyed to the governor's office. If you email, and there were pounds of them, piles of them,
yeah,
tweets.
And we apologize, we didn't get to all of them.
By the way, did you know hashtag Ask Baker actually belongs to somebody else?
Yeah, we knew that.
Okay.
No, we didn't know that. Is that true?
There's a guy who answers all kinds of technical questions at hashtag Ask Baker. I checked it out this morning when I saw it on Twitter.
So what are you going to do?
I don't know.
It wasn't him. You guys
came up with that. And so I went to hashtag Ask Baker this morning just to see what kinds of questions are showing up there. And there's a whole bunch of back and forth between Ask Baker and a whole bunch of very technical
questions. Well, on that note,
before you go,
my carburetor isn't working that well.
Well, that's exactly
on your
right.
way out, can you?
We'll get right on that.
Thank you, Jim. Governor Baker, we really appreciate you doing this. We'll see you next month, and lots of luck, and we're glad you feel better. Thank you so much.
Okay, Governor Baker, again, thank you for being here, too. Just like I want to second what Jim just said, and, well, you already said it, I won't say it again. Coming up, when it comes to decision-making, is our rational self hijacked by our subconscious? Behavioral economist Michael Norton joins us to talk about that next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brody. She is Mardrigan. You know, I always thought that the way we make decisions was pretty straightforward, and that was until Michael Norton walked into Studio 3 with his monthly breakdown of all the things that really shape our behavior. Today he joins us to explain how our rational selves are often hijacked by our subconscious, from pop-up thoughts to even our dreams. Michael Norton is a professor at the Harvard Business School. His latest book is Happy Money, which is terrific, The Science of Happier Spending. Michael, it's great to see you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you guys.
Okay, so what is it you think, please, about people's decision-making, their quick pop-in thoughts, the things that pop into their head versus what they've really thought about deliberately for a long time, which they trust?
So you'd think that people would trust the thing they thought really hard about, right? The whole point
yes.
of thinking about stuff is that you weighed all the pros and cons. You made a list of what's good and what's
exactly.
bad. It turns out, though, that what people really, really trust are the random things that pop into their head, including the random things that pop into their head when they're sleeping, when they're not even trying to think. Those are the things, for some reason, we really think are important and valuable.
Can I tell you, I love you and I respect you. I don't believe this for a second. I'm sorry. How did you do? What study did you do? I didn't mean that to be quite as accusatory as it came out.
It sounded accusatory.
What was? I take it back. Okay, Michael, I'm very fond of you. However, I question the premise. How did you demonstrate this to your satisfaction?
You know, the very first thing we did, so we were amazed that we asked people, have you ever had a dream that came true? And almost everyone said yes. Almost everyone said, yes, I have. And we said, well, when was it? And they said, well, it was about 20 years ago. And we said, have you had other dreams in the meantime that didn't come true? And they said, oh, now that I think about it, yeah, we have. I had a lot of dreams that didn't come true. But when we said, do you believe that dreams come true? They said, yes, because I had one dream 20 years ago that came true. So almost everyone has this lay belief that dreams somehow tell you about the future. Even though most of our dreams are us, like riding a unicorn on Saturn, for some reason,
that one, and that did come true.
Exactly.
Actually, that's the one 20 years ago.
So we have this weird thing where things pop into our head when we're dreaming, and we think, oh my God, that means everything. I need to change my flight, or someone's cheating on me, or I need to get a new job because I had this dream last night.
Okay, so forget the dream for a second. I think I accept that one. I'm about to...
Let me just give an example.
I'm about to pick a cell phone company. And I've done tons of research because I want great service and I want to make sure I spend the least money for good service. I spend 12 hours searching, doing comparative stuff on the internet. I decide it's, let's say, Verizon. And all of a sudden, as I'm about to click the button, what comes into my head is I love the way the guy looked on the commercial for AT&T. you were saying that the average person trusts more the AT&T pop-up thought than he or she does all that considered deliberate research he or she did?
They really do, and in particular in cases when they're having a hard time deciding. So people will often, when you're really struggling with a decision, there's research that shows that people, when they finally decide, right after that, they'll think, no, the other one's better, and they'll switch right away. So immediately after they've done all, exactly as you said, the due diligence and everything, as soon as that's done, they get a feeling. They describe it as kind of like a hunch that maybe the other one's better. But the problem is that whichever one they ended up on, they'll switch to the other one because now it popped into their head that maybe that's better. So even reasonable people will sometimes say, I know that's the right decision, but something inside of me is making me feel like I need to switch.
Is this because people don't trust themselves? Is that – I'm trying to – I accept that this is real because you say it's real based on your research. But what's the rationale? Is because we don't trust our own judgment? Is that what it is?
We thought about calling this paper, I kid you not, The Universe is Trying to Tell Me Something.
Yeah, exactly.
People have a strange belief that somehow if they strip away – all of their earthly cares and concerns and overthinking and all the things we do, that somehow something will be revealed to them that is the truth. And they're hoping that if they get the unfiltered truth of it, that will be the right answer. And so we use things like, nah, I have this hunch right now, I better go with it, instead of all the stuff we should be perhaps using, like thinking and reasoning.
But you know, Michael Norton, part of it I think has to do with the fact that you hear all the time, trust your gut, your first impression, go with what, you know, especially when you're judging people maybe, or judging, you know, the famed, you know, fork in the road kind of deal. Trust your gut. Where did you think the house really was located, sort of thing? So I think that's going to have something to do with it, doesn't it?
I think it does. The idea is we ask people about a whole bunch of ways of thinking about the world. And it turns out that the ones that are kind of deliberate, like thinking hard and ruminating, people don't think those tell you as much as things like letting your mind wander and letting something pop into your head, or trusting your gut, or Freudian slips. Right?
Yeah.
You meant to say one thing, but then something else came out. That was the universe trying to tell you something. And that's the thing that's real. Even though there's no evidence, in fact, that that's the thing that's real, we have, as you said, this strong belief.
But speaking of Freudian slips, wasn't Freud the big guy that was obsessed with whatever was dreaming all the time? I mean, so you could see where some people might think, okay, well, he was some genius way back when. He was into dreams. Why shouldn't I be into my own dreams?
You know, we asked people all over the world their intuition about what dreams are. And we gave them the latest scientific theories about what dreams are, which is, for example, they can be used to help you consolidate information during the day. There are some that suggest it's just truly random firings of neurons. We asked people, which theory of dreams do you believe is correct? Everyone says the Freud one. Everybody says, all over the world, here, India, South Korea, everybody says it's definitely the Freud one. That really has permeated our consciousness that dreams are powerfully meaningful and true.
Now, the most important part of this discussion with Michael Norton from Harvard Business School, and by the way, we're going to get your thoughts on this in a couple of minutes at 877-301-8970. Are you amongst the people who Michael is talking about who go with those pop-up thoughts, your dreams, over rational, deliberative process? I want to get to the consequence of that in a minute. But almost everything you do, when I read about it, Michael, I say to myself, how did you conceive of looking into this issue? What prompted you and your colleagues to say, I want to know if people go more with that pop-up thought than with their own deliberative thought process?
So my collaborator on this research, Carrie Morwedge, who's a professor at Boston University, we had a conversation one day, and he said, I'm going to say something weird. He said, I think that people believe their dreams way more than they should. Mm-hmm. And the reason was, he kept hearing people, these are people who have PhDs from fancy institutions who are supposed to know better. They kept saying, I had this dream about this thing, and I really think I should change my job. Or I had this dream about my spouse cheating on me, and I can't let it go. It's been bothering me all day and all week.
So
and now
the number of a private detective? Is that what they
absolutely,
say?
Absolutely.
Wow. This is,
so it was just sort of an anecdotal, a random kind of conversation.
And so common. That's the thing, is so many people will talk about a dream they had that's lingering with them. And they know it's not real, but it sticks with us, and we feel like we need to do something about it. And Carrie and I thought, that's such a powerful and common human experience. What the heck is going on? We should study it.
But so the consequence, unfortunately, to me, and I assume you'll disabuse me of this, is that since we're going to go with the, I'll call it the random thought. I know that's not your term of art here, but the random thought, you know what I mean? Rather than the deliberative one, mm-hmm. don't waste time engaging in deliberative, excruciating thought processes, because ultimately you're going to go with what Marjorie describes as your gut anyway. I mean, you're shaking your head like that. Isn't that a reasonable conclusion to reach?
Well, it doesn't mean you're going to make a good decision when you go with your gut. It just means it might save you a little bit of time when you go with your gut, because we often override what we thought about. But when we see people believing the random thought that pops into their head, it can be a thought that really isn't meaningful at all. But because we pop it into your head, now you think it's really important. So it's not a good thing or bad thing necessarily. And it can really lead you astray to think, I had this thing in this dream, I need to get a divorce, when in fact the dream was completely
random. Oh, you think
random.
So?
So you did this thing, which I found very fascinating. You went to this Boston train station, asked people to imagine what four possible scenarios happened the night before a scheduled airline trip. Do you remember what they were?
Yeah, so we told people, think about if you had a thought that a plane crash was going to happen tomorrow. So you have a flight tomorrow. Imagine that day you think, geez, I wonder if there's going to be a plane crash tomorrow. Another one is that you had a dream about a plane crash tomorrow, which are kind of the same, thinking about it, dreaming about it. Another thing that we asked people to think about was, what if the Department of Homeland Security raised the threat alert? And the final one was, what if there was an actual plane crash on the same route? And we asked all four groups of people, how likely would you be to change your flight? Now, you might think that raising the threat of a terrorist attack or perhaps even an actual plane crash would be the worst thing that would make you change your flight. Having a dream was as bad or even worse than those real things. People couldn't shake the idea that if I dream about a plane crash tomorrow, why would I get on a plane?
Okay, our number is 877-301-8970. We want to know if you're organizing your entire life around the dreams that you had a week ago or 6 weeks ago, or if you've divorced your spouse because you dreamed that they were cheating on somebody else.
As Michael is speaking, I'm saying to myself, and I'm a fairly impulsive person, so while I'm ridiculing this whole notion, I'm realizing I am who he's talking about. Are you? Do you go with impulsive thoughts? Forget dreams for a second. We get to dreams as a separate thing.
I don't remember my dreams.
Okay, so I generally don't either. But how about impulsive thoughts that pop in your head? You agonize over a lot of things, as we well know.
Well, I think some part of it's a laziness with me, though. I mean, I can spend all this time, and I know you're a big Consumer Reports guy. You research all this stuff.
Everything, yes.
I mean, I tend to just walk in and look at about five things. If that looks good, I'll buy it, sort of thing. So, because I'm lazy about really thinking through a lot of decisions, and I figure I'm not going to be able to get the right answer. I mean, we've talked about this before with you, like a 401k. You know, I have nowhere. So I just throw caution to the wind and guess, and it probably has worked out very badly for me.
That's how we pick most of the topics for the show,
it
too,
has.
Michael. I want you to
you know.
What
I mean? There's a laziness.
Yeah,
I feel very validated as being a guest.
Okay, so are you one of these people? I'm still, as you can tell, are you one of these people too? I mean, you seem to be an incredibly thoughtful character. I don't know you outside the studio, and I read your stuff, that sort of thing. Are you the kind of person who will go with an impulse over a deliberative thing, Michael Norton?
Sometimes you have to.
What does that mean?
For sure in the world. So there are some decisions that you can think, but in the end, it really is a gut thing. Do I want to do this or not? But there are different categories of these random sorts of thoughts, right? So it may be if you're deciding, you know, to get married or not, you can't really think that through. It's a leap of faith to do these kinds of decisions. But if you're making your decisions based on having a random dream about something crazy, that's probably not the kind of information you want to be using. But that seems to be the kind of information that people really like to use, is this random stuff. Instead of maybe sometimes your gut is telling you something important and you should listen to it, but sometimes the other random stuff that really is noise, that's the stuff that we find that people really interpret a lot and they really shouldn't be.
And so you may have said this already, but is part of the reason why people go in the direction that you're suggesting they do based on your research, Michael Norton, is because the feeling is if it just pops into your head – either while you're sleeping and you do – I don't remember dreams for the most part either – or it pops up in your waking hours, that it's probably the most honest and unfiltered part of you as opposed to the one that's reacting to the environment around you. Is that part of the deal too?
That's exactly right. And that really is why we think Freudian slips are so great, right? Because you didn't mean to say that.
Right.
And we think, if he didn't mean to say it,
he must really mean it.
But it could be just it came out wrong because you mixed your words up. But we have this strong theory that if you didn't mean it, it's the truth. And we do that with other people. And the funny thing is we do it to ourselves too. If I didn't mean to think that, oh my God, it must mean it's the real truth about who I am and what I want out of life.
Michael, one more question for me before we get to the calls. By the way, the number is 877-301-8970. You were talking about people thinking that the universe is trying to tell them something. So maybe people find that comforting, you know, not necessarily a God thing or a religious thing, but just they like the idea that the universe, whatever that is looking out for me.
I think that's right. In fact, we ran a study with people. We asked them if they believe in God or not. And then we told them, imagine you had a dream where God spoke to you. And some people, we said, God spoke to you and told you to take a year off and travel the world. And other people, we said, God spoke to you and told you to take a year off and work in a leper colony. And we asked people, how much would you believe the dream? It turns out that people who believe in God believe both dreams equally. So when God, if you believe in God and he speaks to you in a dream, you say, year off, absolutely. Leper colony, absolutely. People who don't believe in God, they believe the take a year off and travel dream, but they don't believe the take a year off and do the leper colony. So we have this general thing where dreams are meaningful, but we do let our own earthly desires play into it and decide what we believe or not.
Well, let me just say, I'm an agnostic, but someone is telling me we have to take a break. And so I'm going to go with it. Marjorie, is that okay with you? We're going to take a break.
Absolutely, Jim.
Michael Norton is going to stick around. We're going to test – they're not theories. We're going to test his research out on you. Give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. Are you the one who goes with the impulse, the dream, over the deliberative thought? Don't go away. Telling me we should continue. So let's. I am Jim Browder. She is Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. Here with us in Studio 3 is actually one of our favorite guests, behavioral economist Michael Norton. Not that the others aren't favorites, of course. We've been talking about his research on how we make decisions and why we apparently, according to Michael and his research, we put more value on our subconscious, things like dreams, pop-up thoughts, than we do in our rational selves and our rational decisions. So does this ring true for you? Have you ever deliberated over something thoughtfully, only to toss all of that aside when a spontaneous thought just tells you to do something else? And have your dreams affected – this is going to get weird, I can tell you. Have your dreams affected decisions you make in your conscious life? The number is 877-301-8970. If I wasn't clear, Michael is sticking around to speak to you as you call. Let's start with Mary Lou in Rhode Island. You're on with Michael Norton on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Mary Lou.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
And, since he's studied dreams so much, I've had a question many years I haven't had an answer for. So I'm pretty pragmatic. And but when I went to college, and this was about 30 years ago, I went, you know, I was in medicine. I went around on different rotations. And there had been a specific doctor that really, you know, I couldn't even tell you his name. It was very sort of superficial contact with. And then my friend and I that year, as we graduated, we took a trip to Italy. And we woke up in the morning. We were in Rome. And I said to her, you know, I had this really strange dream. And, you know, there was this doctor and we were sitting, you know, on the steps and I looked up and there was a fountain and there he was. And lo and behold, that afternoon, we were sitting on the steps near the Trevi Fountain. And I looked up and this particular person was there. And
wow.
It was the most bizarre thing. And fortunately, I told my friend about it. Otherwise, I wouldn't have believed it. She still to this day, you know, will witness that. So, but
okay.
Nothing like that. And, you know, I don't believe, you know, I don't call the psychic hotline. And
so, yeah.
Well, you apparently are calling the psychic hotline right now, Mary Lou.
So what's your question? You want to know what Michael thinks about this?
So I wonder what he thinks about
that.
Okay, let's hear it.
We got it. Go ahead, Michael. What do you think?
I thought you were going to end by saying that then you marry the doctor because the coincidence was – because sometimes people will do that. If there's such a strange coincidence like that, people will think it's destiny.
What's a meant-to-be kind of thing?
Yeah, there's some research that shows that if you got on a train that you don't usually get on and meet someone, you think it's more important than if you take your regular train. There's all kinds of funny things that we do here. My guess is, though, I think I said this briefly at the beginning, many people will say, I had a dream that came true. But if you think about the number of dreams you've had in your lifetime, I don't know how many because we don't really know how many people have every night. But let's say you've had like a billion different dreams. It's likely that one will come true.
Yeah.
This one is particularly interesting because it's so random and rare that that would happen. But we seem to not give any weight to the, I don't know what one less than 1 billion is. We'll have to do the math. 999 million. We don't give any weight to any of the ones that didn't come true. We seem to focus on the ones that came true. And that's why we still have this intuition that they always come true, even though we know I had one last night and it didn't come true today.
Mayor Lou, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Let's go to Jillian from Chelmsford. What do you think, Jillian?
Hi, Jillian.
Well, I kind of come from a unique perspective because both I'm someone who traditionally has a really hard time making decisions, and I'm also a therapist, so I get to hear a lot about how people make decisions. What I would say is I feel like there's not enough credit being given to that gut feeling and to the dreams and things, because I really believe, and I know kind of this for myself, that I process a lot when I'm dreaming. So a lot of times I'm processing information while I dream in my subconscious in many different layers. And when I wake up with a strong feeling, it's usually because I've processed it and I've really come to a conclusion. And what I've found is when I don't get that gut feeling and I don't have a strong intuition, a lot of times it is literally because I don't really have enough information to make the decision. And so my subconscious is trying and trying and trying it, but it's processing as much as it can, and it doesn't come up with an answer. And then I'm sort of reduced to having to go to rational thought and sit down and make a list and look at things and stuff like that. But it never really feels that good, because the truth is I don't have enough information to really make a good decision. I'm going to have to, like, make a leap of faith, like when I got married. That was very challenging because there's so much you can't know about. You have to just ultimately do it. And so the rational thought is sort of your best guess, but it's not really going to give you the answer you're looking for.
That was a wildly interesting call, I should say. How about Michael Norton?
Maybe she married that doctor from The Fountain. The other story. Yeah, I think, I mean, one of the things that dreaming things and waking up and feeling certain about something, it's a great feeling. You know, it's a wonderful feeling to think that the universe has spoken to you.
Exactly.
And now you know. Our research shows that sometimes we think that even when, in fact, the universe hasn't really spoken and it just is because we dreamed it. It doesn't mean, though, that sometimes dreams don't have real information. There's a fascinating study. They looked at an earthquake in California. And over the ensuing weeks, they looked at the frequency of nightmares that people had. And it turns out you could predict the frequency by how far they were from the epicenter of the earthquake. But the dreams weren't about the earthquake. So people were having stress dreams because they were stressed in their lives from this experience. Mm-hmm. So the dreams were meaningful in that you could tell how far they were from the earthquake. But they were having dreams about getting a new job and all these sorts of random things. So there was deep meaning in them in terms of what had happened in their lives. But they weren't actually using these dreams to make these big decisions in their lives. That's when dreams get a little more problematic in using them.
Jillian, thank you for your thoughtful call. I know this was not intended to be a dream session with you, but since this has evolved into this, at least to a degree, why is it that Marjorie says, I don't remember any of my dreams, nor do I? I mean, maybe one a month. And we both know people who get up every day and remember they think, of course, that they remember something concrete from the night. Why the difference in all of us? Do you know?
Yeah, so some of it has to do with how deeply we sleep and how quickly we come out of a dream state when we wake.
Okay.
So some people will come out quickly and remember the dream. It also depends on how much you sleep and how regular your sleeping is. So if you have to get up at 4 a.m. and the alarm goes off, many, many people will be dreaming right then.
That is absolutely true. Because don't you remember when you set it up really early in the morning? I remembered a lot more of my dreams then at that getting up 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yes, but if you're in a pattern where you get up at 9 and you went to bed at a reasonable time, often your body is bringing you out kind of in anticipation, so you don't wake up with these crazy, oh my God, I was just driving a race car on the moon kind of feeling.
Yeah. Are you troubled at all by this research that the subconscious or the impulse is driving decision making more than thought is driving decision making, or do you not make those kind of judgments?
It can be troubling for people. So there are some people who only speak to the universe and wait for things to come to them and make all the decisions based on that. They usually live in Arizona and they have crystals and things, you know.
Okay, fine.
And they don't often always make the best life decisions. Using it sometimes, especially as the last caller said, when you really don't know, using these kinds of things, it doesn't necessarily make you wrong. It probably isn't going to make you more right in many cases, though.
Yeah, and what if it turns out that a substance that is not a natural substance causes you to get to this state? How does that factor in?
So people massively believe that when other people are under the influence, they speak the truth. Is huge
intuition that we have. I mean, that's not as someone under the influence. I absolutely believe. Do you believe that?
There's very mixed evidence for when people are under the influence of substances, whether they are more truthful or not, because they're also more variable, let's say, when you're on certain substances. So they might say something about how they feel about you when they're on whatever they're on, and you think, my God, that's really how they feel. But the next thing they say is that they are feeling that the walls are melting away.
Yeah.
And we don't think that that's crazy. So the last thing they said was crazy. We think the first one was amazingly insightful. And then the second one is crazy, right? So we have these funny inconsistencies.
And does this matter whether we're talking about, you know, liquor or marijuana or psychedelic mushrooms? I mean, the variance must be huge.
Maybe we can get some callers who've just done each of those
things.
Yeah,
we should get some
callers. We will.
Anybody who's, you know, on an acid trip right now.
Let's go to Cambridge, where John is on with Michael Norton. Hi there, John.
Hi.
Hi. You're on.
I'm wondering whether gender and shopping enters into this.
Shopping.
Well, gender question, I understand. What's the shopping question?
I'm a complete impulse buyer.
Oh.
And you're a man, obviously.
Go ahead.
I drove my mother and my wife absolutely crazy because they were the kind of people who would go through a store endlessly looking for just the right garment or piece of furniture or whatever.
Yeah, we actually have some research now that looks at serendipity. And one of the things that people really like is when they randomly get something, they feel somehow that it was important. So if a song randomly comes on, you believe that somehow that was meant to happen and you must love that song. And many people have this experience of, I was driving and this song came on. Whereas if they'd chosen that song, it wouldn't feel that meaningful or important. But when it happens, somehow it feels like this is our song have to get married to and all these sorts of things. So sometimes when people shop, a similar thing can happen.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Do you trust, that's our question this hour, do you trust your impulses? Do you trust your dreams? Do you trust these random thoughts that kind of pop into your head when making decisions more than sitting down with your list, the pros and the cons, or not?
You know, Michael, you're saying that the majority of people fall into that prior category, impulse over. Is this a dramatic difference, meaning a dramatic majority, a slim? I mean, you're shaking your head. Yes, it is.
Yeah, so something like 60 to 80% of people think the Freud thing is right, that when this stuff pops into our heads,
it's real.
Something.
Go with it.
Now, we vary whether we're going to make a career decision on that or just be bothered by it. But nearly everyone, and the example I often use is, you dream about your spouse being unfaithful. Can you wake up and say, that was just a dream and you're done? Very few people can just completely dismiss it. At least for 10 minutes, an hour, who knows how long it lasts. Nearly all of us have some feeling that we need to interpret that before we let it go.
Does this happen to you? This guy? I don't mean that particular one, but I mean, have you experienced this kind of thing?
Where things pop into my head.
And you go with them?
Well, I'm a hyper-rational Harvard Business School professor, so we don't have intuition. We just have facts and figures that we decide everything.
You know, I was saying this to you during the break. I think some of this has to do with you want to believe that your judgment is sound, because it's a very scary thing in the world to think that you have no intuition, you have no judgment, you have no ability to have that gut reaction to things, that's got to be part of this too.
I think it absolutely is.
But you don't think that's scarier? I mean, you don't think the notion that your gut reaction is where you go is a scare? Then what's the point of planning? What's the point of researching? What's the point of – why are you looking at me so strangely, Margaret?
Well, I think it depends on what you're talking about. I mean, I think people like to think that their view of the world and their perspective is valid and not – ridiculous. And so
you mean your visceral one, your internal?
Yes.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
So,
okay.
And so that if
okay.
you're wrong all the time, all the time, it's
point.
Very scary.
Right. So there's two issues. One is, are you making a good decision? And the other one is, do you feel good about the decision you made?
Yes. Yeah.
And you'd like it to be you made a good decision and you feel good about it. But if you made a bad decision, it can still be the case that if you dream that it was the right decision, you feel better about it. So it doesn't necessarily mean it's good that dreams make you feel like you did the right thing. But you might be right that it's better than just feeling your whole life every day, I don't know if I made a good decision or not.
Oy,
like
Amanda,
who am I and why am I here?
Exactly.
Thing,
exactly.
You know what I mean?
Amanda, you're in Maine, but now you're on Boston Public Radio with Michael Norton. Thanks for the call, Amanda.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I've got a question. I have some of my craziest ideas and some of my best ideas in that state right before you fall asleep. But you're conscious. I'm conscious enough to know that, geez, I should really write that comment down. But next thing you know, I jump on a unicorn and I go and I execute that idea. So I'm curious, what state is that? What am I sleeping? Am I awake?
Great question.
What's happening right then?
What is that?
Yeah, there's a whole Seinfeld episode, actually, that was devoted to right before he fell asleep, Jerry wrote down a joke that he thought was hilarious. And then he lost it. And the episode was him trying to find the joke that he wrote down. And then he found it and it wasn't funny. So sometimes we think that the thing that we had at that moment, and it is this reason because it seems to come to us. We let go of the day's concerns. We're lying in our bed. We're letting our mind wander a bit and the things pop into our head. And controlling for how good the idea is, we think it's better than it might be because it seems to pop into our head. It's like the universe, all day the universe hasn't been speaking to me. And finally... It is. Here it comes, and I'll write it down. And then the Seinfeld episode is about how it might not really be the universe speaking to you. It might just be a random thing that happened.
Amanda, thank you much for the call. 877-301-8970. Let's go to Peter. Peter's in Boston, and he's on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Peter.
Hi, guys. How are you doing today?
We're excellent. Thank you much for the call.
This is my first time calling, but I love this subject. I got 2 points.
Please.
I just want to make with you guys is... the one on where Mike's saying, you know, you make decisions when things pop up. I honestly believe it's very superstitious. And how much superstition has to do with this? Whether you walk under a ladder, you break a mirror, how many people actually believe that the universe is talking to them or there's a spirit or your mother, you know, in heaven is trying to send you in the right direction by making these decisions that pop up? And the second thing is that the dreams, I know a couple of callers ago, that things come true. You haven't touched the point on deja vu because I believe that, you know, you dream a lot more than you think and you don't remember it. And then one day you're sitting here going, geez, I've been here before. I remember this. Or this had happened. And, you know, it's just very familiar to you. In some kind of situation where you don't know where it came from.
You know, Peter, that's a great question. You know what this is becoming? This is becoming one of those radio shows you listen to at 2 a.m. when you wake up. It's coming. This is great. Those are a couple of great questions, Peter. Thanks for making the call. How about it?
I think a fascinating study on deja vu. So they had people walking through the woods, and they asked them, at any point if you experience deja vu, can you signal that you're experiencing deja vu? So these people were walking through the woods and some whatever, walking around. And then some of them started saying, I feel like I have deja vu. I feel like I've been here before. I feel like I've been here before. And they were tracking where they were walking, and they were lost. And it turns out that when they were having the experience of deja vu, they had been there before.
5 minutes earlier.
And they just forgot. So they thought it was some mystical experience of a previous life of Napoleon.
So
and in fact, they really had been there before. So again, it's this feelings that we have that are not always supported by the facts.
You know, I love the fact that in our previous lives, we were always Napoleon or we were Cleopatra or, we were, you know, Queen Elizabeth or something. We were never just some, you know.
And we're never just Dave.
Exactly.
Let's squeeze one more in if we can. Sam, you're in Charlestown. You're on with Michael Norton. You know what we're talking about. Hi there.
Yeah, hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think I've begun to understand something that I've never been able to understand. And
what's
that? I just want to run this by you. Like, so I believe the guest has some background in economics. And the thing that, like Reaganomics, I never understood that. It always seemed like the stupidest, craziest thing. And now I'm beginning to think that maybe, in fact, it is crazy because it's not based on rational thought. And maybe Ronald or maybe one of his advisors like had a dream or something, or just intuition, like, oh, I got it, let's trickle it down.
What was his name, David Stockman? Was that who it was?
I think so, yeah.
Stockman was his HUD guy. But they were all kind of like, they had these flat, or I know, we'll have a Star Wars defense system. I had this drink. These things weren't based on rational policy. These people are all like, great, right? That's a possibility, right?
Okay, that is one of the best questions we've had in weeks, actually. How about that? Come on.
Do your analysis of Ronald Reagan.
Come on, Michael
and the trickle-down economics.
Or people on the other side of the spectrum may say that Barack Obama was asleep, and he said, you know, something about Obamacare that I think I got to do. And then lo and behold, what's the answer?
I think I was actually thinking of with Reagan that Nancy Reagan was famous for using astrology.
Of course, that's right. She did, for
and
real.
Many politicians in one form or another on both sides of the aisle will use some sort of extra aid to try to aid their decision-making. I can't speak to the specific dreams of specific people, but it certainly is the case that when you have this feeling that the universe spoke to you, whether it's a dream or in your everyday life, you really do start to think this is amazing.
Yeah.
We should really pursue this. It can be sometimes, at least in our everyday lives, why we do things that aren't in our best interest.
Now, Michael, before you go, are you able to share us what weird thing you're in the middle of right now, or you can't?
You mean what dream I'm in the middle of?
No, not what dream you're in the middle of. What weird research project have you and your colleagues conjured up that you're in the midst of now? Can you tell us or no?
One of the things that we're working on actually is this idea of when and why kids stop singing and dancing. At what age and why they stop, and why adults are so reluctant to sing and dance, even though little kids do it and they're so happy.
When are we going to be ready on that one?
Very soon.
That's a great one. I think I know.
Well, don't say. Don't say. Why?
As soon as you realize how ridiculous you look. Yeah.
Well, don't give it away. In any case, Michael Norton, it's a joy to see you as always. Thanks so much.
Okay. Michael Norton is a brilliant professor at the Harvard Business School. His latest book, which you should really read, it's a terrific book, Happy Money, The Science of Happier Spending. Michael, thanks for being with us. Up next, WGBH arts editor Jared Bowen joins us to review this year's Oscar nods. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. So here with us in Studio 3 to go over the Oscars 2015 snubs, surprises. You know, they came out this morning as GBH Arts Editor Jared Bowen. Jared, it's nice to see you.
It's great to see you.
How excited are you at 8:30 in the morning when you know they're about to do it? Are you like hyperventilating or what are you doing?
I'm not hyperventilating. Thank you for painting that picture of me. However, I am probably the same as when I was about 8 years old and I really realized how much I loved movies, and I do really get so excited about this.
You know what's amazing before we get into the content? As you know, because we discuss with you almost every week the best plays, movies, museums, etc., I don't see nearly as much as I used to, and I'm wildly excited about this. I can't even explain it. How would you explain that?
Because it's very, very simple. It's the thread back to the old Hollywood. I mean, whether you grew up watching Bob Hope host the Oscars or Johnny Carson, it doesn't really change. It's the same formula. We get to find out which are the best movies. We get to see the stars come out for them. We get to see funny jokes on the stage. And it really doesn't change. And I don't think it should change. There's always this conversation about, do they have to change the show to make it younger and more palatable for ratings? But no, it's just the fun old Hollywood glamour, I think.
Who is going to be the host this year?
Neil Patrick Harris.
Of course.
Oh, Neil Patrick Harris.
Who else?
He's terrific. Although I did, as we talked about earlier in the week, Amy Poehler and
Tina Fey
were fantastic, I thought, doing the Golden Globes.
Okay. I thought they were hilarious.
Yeah,
hilarious.
Absolutely.
Okay, so
fantastic.
Let's start at the top of the list.
He's got eight. Once again, I wish they went back to the five.
Well, they could do 10. Isn't that a new rule up to 10?
Up to 10. It's hideous.
Terrible.
It's ridiculous that they do eight.
Too many.
And I think it hurts the box office, too, because I know a lot of people who used to make a thing of you at least
go see the five
pictures, and now you're spending $1 billion to try to see all eight. Now.
So give us the highs, the lows, who should be there, who shouldn't, who wasn't there, who should be, all that kind of thing. Let's start with Best Picture.
Best Picture. So we have American Sniper, Birdman, or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance. That's its full title.
I didn't know that.
Boyhood, The Grand Budapest Hotel, The Imitation Game, Selma, The Theory of Everything, and Whiplash. And I think this is really a competition between Birdman and Boyhood. And it's interesting because you don't have big blockbusters this year. In past years, you've had The Hobbit, or not The Hobbit, but The Lord of the Rings films, or Titanic, which was gargantuan in terms of box office. And last year at this time, the all Best Picture nominees together, and they're about roughly the same number, had made $648.6 million at the box office.
Wow.
This year it's only $202.
Wow, that is amazing.
Because, so, yeah, it's rife with independent movies this year.
So why Birdman and Boyhood? Why those are the two big contenders?
I think they just have the most momentum. It's great filmmaking in each, and I have full disclosure, I still haven't seen Boyhood. It came out the summer when I was away, and I just haven't had a chance to catch up with it. It finally arrived at my house this morning, I think, so I'll get to see it. But I know enough about it to know about the filmmaking. And the same with Birdman. It's completely inventive and different in that you're in this theater. For people who don't know the story, Michael Keaton stars as this actor trying to find redemption later in life after playing an action hero, not unlike him playing Batman in real life. But the filmmaking is so great because you wind through this theater and it's done in these long continuous takes, 10 minutes long each of these takes, and you really get the sense of all these characters. By the way, most of whom got Oscar nominations, which I think portends well for this: Emma Stone, Ed Norton, Michael Keaton.
The reason I'm dying to see this movie, beyond the fact that I love Michael Keaton, is it's really about a has-been, and I expect to be one quite soon, actually.
Exactly.
No, I'm serious. So I want the most fun.
Well, that means you have to run through probably, I don't know, downtown Brighton in your underwear.
I've done that, so I'm ready for it. Now, and you've seen me do it too, Jared. So, Jared, the fun always is who got screwed, if you'll excuse the expression. Who should have been on the list, who wasn't?
There are a whole bunch this year. It's always my favorite part, too. Well, Jennifer Aniston, there was a lot of conversation about her in this film that has yet to come out, but it's called Cake. She's a woman who's sort of fallen apart, and she's trying to pull herself back together. She didn't get a nomination. Amy Adams did not get a nomination for Big Eyes. We talked
about
that.
Amy Adams just won at the Golden Globes the other day. Did she not?
The Golden Globes are hardly ever barometer. Right. Selma, and I know you loved Selma.
Yeah.
And if you had just listened to me a month ago, you wouldn't be so surprised right now, but that only got two nominations. And actually,
Best Picture and what else?
Best Picture and for Best Song.
No
and
actor.
You know, it's interesting
no
too.
Actor.
Well, also because this is the first African American woman that has been the director of a major Oscar contender, and I thought she might because she's so impressive. We saw her in Boston when we did that at the premiere in Boston.
She was there
for the
live
press.
For the thing. Yeah,
yeah. And they had that full page thing about her in the New York Times. I mean, she's had a wonderful career. Nothing.
She had all the momentum behind her, and I really thought. I mean, she did. I do believe that she deserved to have one of the five slots, and I think it's surprising that she didn't. You have to remember that the Oscars are so much about campaigning. This is a business, after all. This isn't necessarily just about merit. It is about who spends the money, who markets, who campaigns well, who appears in the most places.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of factors here. But I agree with you. And the same with David Oyelowo, who played Martin Luther
fabulous.
King. He is such a great actor and has been for a long time in a number of films. And I do think it's a travesty that he wasn't nominated either in the Best Actor category.
You know, most people think, and I think this is a fair statement, you know better than I, that there's a left-leaning tilt in terms of Hollywood and those who vote. And so the conventional wisdom is things like Selma, particularly since it is the first major movie made about King. Is it? And I believe it is.
In recent
commercial
memory,
thing,
certainly,
yeah. So while it did get that nom, and many people thought it would, it's conceivable that the whole brouhaha over the historical accuracy vis-a-vis the depiction of LBJ as the reluctant civil rights or at least voting rights warrior, maybe that had a negative impact. I'm not a student of this like you. I'm really surprised. I thought it was going to win like 7, 8, 9 nominations.
Or is it the box office? Because it's not been great.
But Jared's saying most of these things are not huge box office successes.
None of them had major box office. I think – I'm not sure about the time frame for the voting because they all have to get their ballots in. And I think the ballots are probably mostly in before this big controversy erupted, because this is a conversation that we've only been having in the last couple of weeks about how accurate they were with history. I think when people were talking about that and playing with history, there was a question about how it may affect it long term.
You know, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is the way the Academy works is everybody gets to vote for both the nominations and the winner of Best Picture. But other than that, you only vote in the category in which you are, meaning if you're an actor, you do that. If you're a director, is that right?
That's right. Yep.
Okay, so let's move on. Let's do the actresses in the leading role. Who are the nominees?
So the actresses in a leading role, I have to find my Marianne Cotillard. That's a big surprise.
Yeah.
She's probably the one who took Jennifer Aniston's slot for Cake.
Poor Jennifer Aniston.
And she's nominated for 2 Days, One Night, in which she plays somebody who's spending that amount of time trying to get her job back. She's a Belgian mother, so this came out of nowhere. But she's a great actress, and she is, along with Reese Witherspoon, the only one who's actually won in this category. And Reese Witherspoon. Spoon is up for Wild, Rosamund Pike for Gone Girl, Julianne Moore for Still Alice, and Felicity Jones as the beleaguered wife in The Theory of Everything. She's Stephen Hawking's wife in that film. And I think this may be Julianne Moore's year for Still Alice in this depiction of Alzheimer's. She's been nominated for five times now, two times in the leading actor category, twice in the supporting actor. She deserves it. And, you know, obviously that comes into play, too, even though they never gave it to Peter O'Toole and some other richly deserving people when they came up after so many nominations.
Peter O'Toole, I remember near the end, did he get one of those lifetime achievement things near the end? I think he did.
One of
the greatest actors of several generations. He was brilliant. He was absolutely, not just Lawrence of Arabia-esque, but so, what's the name of that movie that he did with Richard Burton about one of the most,
Manfred Seasons?
About the Archbishop, was it Manfred Seasons? Archbishop of Canterbury and the King.
Thomas
and
Moore.
It was unbelievable. So who's missing? By the way, you're promoting Jennifer Aniston?
I'm just saying this is what they're talking about. I haven't seen the film.
She deserves something.
She is horrible.
Can you imagine being
Excuse me.
Jennifer Aniston's husband runs off with Angelina Jolie, you know, the most
sexy. So you got a nominator as a result?
And then they have like 19,000 kids. And Jennifer Aniston, every time she goes to buy a pack of gum or goes anywhere, she has to see Angelina and Brad on the cover of every magazine.
So give her a throw her a bone?
I just think it's difficult to be Jennifer Aniston.
You know why I turned around a little bit on her? CBS Sunday Morning profiled her. I think it was this last weekend. And the reporter, I think it was Len Cowan, asked her if she ever talks to her ex-husband. And she said, "Do you speak with your ex-wife?" I thought that was
that's pretty good, actually.
Because I'm not a big fan of hers either, but that turned me around. I thought you could see it in her face.
And she's got to be 40 years old by now. She has no children. She got married, I think.
No, she's engaged.
Is this a real conversation?
Yes,
She is by herself. She has no children.
Jennifer,
she was dumped by Brad Pitt.
Well, because if you had to walk into a supermarket every day and look at your ex-spouse, you know, with their glorious life,
fine.
And they're all saving the world, and, you know, the whole thing,
since you're taking the low road, I want to take the low road. I think I've had this discussion with you before.
As often as possible.
The only reason that woman won an actress, and I think she is just totally overrated. She won 2 Academy Awards in a row. The woman who was in the movie with George Clooney. What's her name?
Sandra Bullock.
Sandra Bullock. And she won before for that football thing. Was she not – I'm doing the Marjorie thing here. She won because she was ill-treated by that motorcyclist with tattoos or something.
That's
wasn't that what it was?
Why she won.
Why'd she win?
She's crazy.
Okay, forget that. Let's move on. Let's talk about the best actor nominations.
Still stuck on this, the motorcycle guy. No, I don't think
She
was with a bad guy.
He
was a real jerk.
Jesse James, right?
Jesse James. Okay, let's move on. I shouldn't have brought that up.
Let's look up what happened to him, Jim.
I'm not a guy. I love tattoos, by the way. Just in his case, I don't love them. Okay, what's the best actor thing here?
Okay, so in the best actor category, we have Steve Carell getting his first nomination as the demented DuPont heir in Foxcatcher. We have Bradley Cooper in American Sniper.
Bradley Cooper has had a number of nominations.
He
it's
has.
Amazing.
His third year in
is
a row.
Is that true?
Was he nominated for Hustle? For American Hustle
last year,
great
and then Silver Linings Playbook right before that, and now
did
he's
you
getting
say 3 years in a row.
This is his third year in a row.
Wow!
Yeah, and he's getting great reviews on Broadway right now too. He's fantastic.
Yeah.
And
who else?
Benedict Cumberbatch for The Imitation Game. I know you have a man crush on.
Oh, do I ever? Do I ever? Go ahead.
And since he plays the gay codebreaker in Imitation Game, you actually have a chance. The implication would be. I'm just putting it out
fine.
There. I'm
no,
trying
thank
to help.
You for doing that. Yep. I appreciate it.
JaredBowensMatch.com.
Yes.
Michael Keaton for Birdman and Eddie Redmayne for The Theory of Everything. And he is just absolutely sublime as Stephen Hawking. The transformation that he had to undergo to just even physically portray Stephen Hawking is incredible. And what he does with his voice, I remember when you guys played a clip of it and I listened to it in here without even seeing it, it brought tears to my eyes. That's how good his performance is.
It was great. It was really great.
We actually have a little clip there. We're going to bring tears to your eyes again. Here it is. What's the Hawking movie called? What's it called?
The Theory of Everything.
Theory of Everything. Here it is.
There should be no boundaries. The human endeavor. However bad life may seem, while there is life, there is hope.
Thank you.
Sorry, did you say something?
I said thank you.
So here's my theory of everything, is that Carell wins, and here's why. Hollywood loves to sell. I don't know that this is factually accurate. I'm going to state it that way anyway. They love to celebrate comedians who do serious roles. You know, for years, what was the name of the I think it was a Martin Scorsese movie that Jerry Lewis acted in.
Oh, the King of Comedy.
King of Comedy.
Oh, yes.
And people talk, and he was good, but he wasn't nearly as good. But it was because, oh my God, the great comedian Jerry Lewis played a serious dramatic role. It's all everybody talked about for a year. I don't think he won anything. I don't know if he did or not. I have a feeling, you're shaking your head, no. I have a feeling that's going to happen here, no?
And he's
a local kid, too.
I don't think so. I think, because what they often do is they prop them up and they talk about how great they are, like Jim Carrey.
Jim Carrey's a good example.
You know, and Robin Williams, when he's done dramatic roles.
Well,
he did win for Good Will Hunting, you know, which I shot right here in Boston. But I don't think that's going to be the case here. I think it's really going to be between Michael Keaton and Eddie Redmayne. They both did win at the Golden Globes in the different categories, comedy, musical versus drama. But I think you're going to see either of them win. For some reason, there doesn't seem to be as much momentum for Benedict Cumberbatch, even though I thought he was fantastic in The Imitation Game. And actually, The Imitation Game and Birdman were my two favorite films of the year.
Now, two quick things here. I stand corrected. Jack just emailed to tell me that Jennifer Aniston is 45 years old, actually born February 11th, 1969. I was wrong about her age. But the other thing is about
so that
Michael
makes her even more deserving
for
an Oscar.
That's right. She has suffered enough.
Even five more years, yeah.
But Michael Keaton and Birdman, I mean, this is interesting because, you know, you think of Michael Keaton now as Batman. That was his big role. And I don't think anybody's taken him seriously, really, as Batman. So this is sort of like the character in the movie in some sense.
What do you mean no one's taking him seriously
as Batman?
Well, I don't
think he would have gotten nominated for Best Actor playing Batman.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And now here he is, you know, and he's older in his career. So it's kind of parallel to what the movie's about.
Yeah, it's art imitates life.
Exactly.
Life imitates art. It's this fascinating prism through which this is all happening. But,
yeah.
But you really do get to appreciate him. And he has been at great pains to say, this is not me. This is, you know, this is a wink and a nod, but this is absolutely not me. But it is him that he has become a great, great actor. He always has been. I mean, that's why he had the versatility to star in some of those early pieces that he did and then do a big action blockbuster for which he was really fantastic. I mean, it wasn't a one note performance when he was playing Bruce Wayne and Batman, and now to do this.
You don't get the credit for it, though. And the other thing is, Steve Carell, I mean, he is so creepy in Foxcatcher.
You saw this?
No, but I've watched a lot of the YouTube takeouts. Oh. I haven't seen the movie yet.
He is really unbelievable in this role, and if
terrible.
I had seen it, I'd probably think it even
but,
more.
I mean, you contrast him. He is so – talk about versatility. I mean, we all watched him for years as Michael in The Office, and he was just hysterical. Every time you looked at him, you started to laugh. You talk all the time about that movie, The Sunshine.
Little Miss Sunshine. Everybody was great in that movie.
And now it's just – he's so talented.
Yeah, well, exactly, because it's a little disingenuous to say, and this is not his doing, to say that he came out of nowhere with this performance because he was great in Little Miss Sunshine. He was also fantastic in that film last summer, The Way, Way Back.
Oh, yes.
Where he was this very difficult father, this very unforgiving man in this father role as he's dating this young kid's, this teenager's mother. And you can see his versatility there. And he, it's interesting to hear him talk about this because he said he sort of creeped himself out as he's inhabiting this role as somebody who is very, very you just want to take a shower after watching him because he's so unseemly.
Just, we're running out of time here. I don't know if I have time for one more question, but I was really surprised with the Grand Budapest Hotel because a lot of my friends told me they didn't like it, but everybody's saying it's fantastic, so my friends are wrong.
I wasn't a big fan of it either. I thought visually, as all Wes Anderson's movies are, it's great, and he's got this great visual cinematic vocabulary. But as a film, I didn't love it.
Okay.
When is this thing, by the way?
February 22nd.
February
22nd. I knew
you'd know that. Thank
They'll
you,
be
Jared.
On
it's
Netflix
great to see you.
Shortly after that. Jared Bowen is WGBH arts editor and the host of Open Studio, which you can catch on Channel 2 Friday nights at 8:30. Jared, thanks so much for coming in. That was much fun. Thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. We have our Friday news quiz and a beam deferred, Alex Beam.
One day later than
who usually joins us on Thursdays is going to be in tomorrow instead of today. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen, and our engineer John Parker are our team. I'm Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy. And by the way, if you missed the first of the monthly interviews, Ask the Governor with Governor Charlie Baker, that will be online at WGBHnews.org later this afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks for tuning in.